This is Guns and Butter.
There's something happening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
So once these anthrax attacks occurred, all of a sudden the Patriot Act goes through Congress. And then when the renewal of the Patriot Act came up last year, again, it was being held up, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, some white powder appears at one of the Senate office buildings. There's an anthrax scare, and the next day, the USA Patriot Act is renewed.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Dr. Francis Foyle. Today's show, Biowarfare and the Emergence of Police State America. Francis Boyle is a leading American expert in international law. He was responsible for drafting the Biological Weapons Anti-Terrorism Act of 1989, the American implementing legislation for the 1972 Biological Weapons Convention. Professor Boyle teaches international law at the University of Illinois Champaign. He is author of Destroying World Order, U.S. Imperialism in the Middle East, Before and After September 11th, and Biowarfare and Terrorism, among many other books. On October 7th, 2002, Dr. Boyle launched a national campaign to impeach Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, and Ashcroft for high crimes and misdemeanors.
Francis Boyle, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me on, and my best regards to your listening audience.
I'd like to begin with your book, Biowarfare and Terrorism. When did research into biowarfare begin? Was that during World War II?
Well, yes, we started researching these issues in World War II, although, in fact, back in World War I, as a result of World War I, there was the Geneva Protocol of 1925, primarily intended to deal with chemical weapons, but there was added into it a prohibition on the use of what was then called bacteriological weapons. So this has been a prohibition in international law since 1925.
Now, could you tell us what the Biological Weapons Convention is? Is that what was passed under Nixon in 1972?
That is correct. Basically, Nixon and Kissinger concluded that the United States had a monopoly on weapons of mass destruction, and therefore it would be in the interest of the United States militarily to deny anyone else in the Third World biological weapons, the poor man's atom bomb, such as it were. So for that reason, they supported a British proposal to conclude a biological weapons convention that was pretty much intended to shut down research, development, testing, let alone use of biological weapons. Again, the prohibition on use was already there in 1925. So technically, that was not included in the 1972 convention. The U.S. government did become a party. We had a massive program on the offensive research, development, testing, stockpiling of biological weapons prior to Nixon. And in fact, Seymour Hersh, one of his first books, I believe, documented the state of that program prior to Nixon becoming a party to the convention. And at that point, we said we were complying and proceeded to comply, although it's known that the CIA continued with covert programs all along.
So then would you say that President Nixon signed the Biological Weapons Convention because the United States and, I guess, the Soviet Union were way ahead with nuclear weapons, and they simply didn't want other countries to get these cheaper types of weapons?
That is correct. But, you know, as the late, great Saul Alinsky, the community organizer, once said, people always do the right thing for the wrong reasons, and there's nothing wrong with that. And in this case, certainly it was very important, I think, for the United States government under Nixon and Kissinger to get out of this massive program on offensive biowarfare research, development, testing, stockpiling that we did have, as documented by Cy Hirsch in his very authoritative book.
Now, how did the history of bioweaponry production in the United States proceed under Bush Sr.?
Well, what happened was, putting aside the covert CIA programs, pretty much the Pentagon got out of the business. In fact, among professional military officers, there has always been an aversion to biological and chemical weapons. But unfortunately, there was maintained a CBW division there in the Pentagon. And it was pretty much brought back to life by the Reagan administration. Under the Reagan administration, as you may recall, he populated the administration with large numbers of members of this Committee on Present Danger. Today, we call them the neoconservatives. But Wolfowitz, Bolton, all the rest of these people were put in power at the Pentagon, State Department, so-called arms control, that's what they call themselves, et cetera. And their philosophy was that the United States government should exploit all technology it possibly has in physics, lasers, biotechnology across the board to produce new generations of nuclear weapons, chemical weapons, and biological weapons. For the chemical weapons, this became the so-called binaries. And for biological weapons, DNA genetic engineering. So the Pentagon began to put massive amounts of money into research, development, testing of its so-called biological defense research program, not only at the U.S. government's own laboratories, but also in the private sector, and basically going out and buying off large numbers of so-called life science researchers to get involved in dual-use research in DNA genetic engineering techniques that could be put to offensive purposes. So that was the state of play in the Reagan administration, just all out. And as you know, they were also doing this on offensive nuclear weapons, the Star Wars program, the so-called Peacekeeper, intermediate nuclear forces, et cetera. So everything across the board was being exploited and investigated pursuant to this neocon Committee on Present Danger strategy. At that point, I then proposed drafting the U.S. domestic implementing legislation for the Biological Weapons Convention to try to stop at least what they were doing domestically with these offensive biowarfare programs that, my assessment, clearly violated the Biological Weapons Convention of 1972. So working with the Council for Responsible Genetics, headquartered in Cambridge, Mass., with some of the top life science researchers in the world, especially congregated around Harvard and MIT, I did the draft legislation for the implementing legislation for the Biological Weapons Convention, and in particular to take into account DNA genetic engineering. And we proceeded to lobby it through Congress. To make a long story short, the Reagan people fought it tooth and nail because they understood full well we were going after them. Bush Sr. came to power, and they took a very different approach to the subject and basically supported it. So at that point, my legislation sailed through Congress. We had to repackage it as legislation designed to go after crazy people out there in the third world. But the truth is, we were primarily concerned about going after the crazy people in the Pentagon and their so-called death scientists, I would call them, working in the private sector in the United States at universities, trying to do this dual-use offensive-defensive biowarfare research. So my legislation was approved unanimously by both houses of Congress and signed into law by President Bush Sr. And I think you have to give him credit for that. And so pretty much this work died out. Now, we're not sure exactly what the CIA was doing or ever has been doing, but it appears the CIA sort of ceased and desist, too. And it stayed that way until the Clinton administration in the second term, where Clinton, under the influence of his Secretary of the Navy, Richard Danzig, used to be a law professor. I knew the guy. But in any event, decided to get back into research, development, testing of this dual-use offensive-defensive DNA genetic engineering. And then after September 11th, Bush Jr. simply accelerated the program. As of today, you know, a minimum estimate is that we've spent under Bush Jr. maybe $40 billion on biowarfare work, large amounts of which either violate the Biological Weapons Convention or go directly up to the line, if not cross it.
Now, Dr. Boyle, the legislation, the domestic legislation that you got through for the Council for Responsible Genetics, that was in when, 1989?
That's correct. It was signed by President Bush in 1990, and I did draft it. I had researched it. There was some prior U.S. legislation by Congressman Rodino right after Nixon had gotten the Biological Weapons Convention, but that hadn't gone anywhere. And then I also researched legislation in other states, implementing legislation, Australia, Britain, a few other states. And then I had to draft it to take into account DNA genetic engineering, which really was not around at the time of the BWC itself. And I did put in there life imprisonment. I'm against the death penalty for any reason, so I didn't include that. That still survives in the legislation today. It is codified in the United States Criminal Code, and there have been two amendments since then. I thought I had drafted the most comprehensive piece of legislation you could imagine, but it turned out that under the Reagan administration, these neocons, the Committee on Present Danger people, had been selling weapons-specific biological agents to Saddam Hussein in the hope and expectation that he was going to use it against Iran. And so that was a loophole that I hadn't even thought about, that they were going to do something like that. So there was another amendment added on to try to close that loophole as well. But it does provide for life imprisonment for anyone violating the BWC as interpreted and applied by the Biological Weapons Anti-Terrorism Act of 1989 that I drafted.
Now, you mentioned that President Reagan was transferring bioweaponry to Saddam Hussein for use in the Iraq-Iran war. Did George Bush Sr. continue those transfers?
No, as far as we could tell, there were some transfers. There were at least 40 transfers that the Reagan administration and his neocons, such as Wolfowitz and the rest of them, did authorize, and they clearly violated the Biological Weapons Convention. There might have been a few in the pipeline, but eventually, I believe, to the best of my knowledge, President Bush Sr. Did terminate those, and those did stop. But there could have been a few of those shipments in the pipeline. Those shipments, you know, came, which is terrible to say, the American-type culture collection, which is a scientific research institute, nonprofit. It never occurred to me when I drafted this legislation that American-type culture would do something like that. Likewise, the Center for Disease Control, which is run by the United States government and is there for the purpose of protecting us all, that, too, sent weapon-specific transfers to Saddam Hussein. And again, it had never occurred to me that the Center for Disease Control would pervert itself and its mission by doing something like that, but it did. So again, my act did have to be amended later on to try to rein in these rogue institutions, whether private sector or governmental sector like the CDC. And I should add, I don't think we can trust the CDC anymore on anything after they did this.
I'm speaking with international law professor and author Francis Boyle. Today's show, Biowarfare and the Emergence of Police State America. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Could you talk then about the forced administration of anthrax vaccine to American military personnel and smallpox vaccine to health workers when George Sr. went to war with Iraq?
Yes. At the time, I had no idea why they were doing this, but later it came out the reason they were doing it was that they knew full well that the Reagan administration, in which Bush Sr. and many of these, some of these others served, had provided weapon-specific biological agents to Saddam Hussein with the hope and expectation that he was going to weaponize them and use them against Iran. Now, the problem with these forced inoculations, we had argued this, I had argued this for the first time ever in the court-martial of Captain Dr. Yolanda Hewitt Vaughn, very courageous woman, who refused to serve in Gulf War I, in part for the reason that she did not want to administer these experimental medical vaccines on anthrax and botulinum toxins to U.S. military personnel pursuant to the order by Bush Sr. and Cheney, who was Secretary of Defense at that time. And her position was that this violated the Nuremberg Code on Medical Experimentation, which was correct, and also the Hippocratic Oath applicable to doctors, do no harm. And during her court-martial proceedings, her Article 32 hearing, I did argue this point, and it did go out nationwide. I accused Bush Sr., Cheney, Powell, Schwarzkopf, of committing a Nuremberg crime on our own troops. And then later, Senator Jay Rockefeller held hearings on this matter, and he, too, accused these officials, these Bush Sr. officials, of perpetrating a Nuremberg crime on our own troops. And this later led, in part, to the Gulf War syndrome, which, as you know, the Pentagon still denies it exists. There are other factors, of course, involved in the Gulf War syndrome. Depleted uranium, which is clearly illegal, and its use a war crime. There was massive contamination and pollution and other factors at work. Although, interestingly enough, with respect to the Gulf War syndrome, France refused to have its soldiers vaccinated. They had been through this once before in the Vietnam War, and there have been very few reports of Gulf War syndrome for French troops that did serve in Gulf War I. But the British troops were inoculated, and they've come down with Gulf War syndrome. As you know, U.S. troops were inoculated, too. Over 10,000 members of U.S. Armed Forces that served in Gulf War I have now died, and large numbers of them have reported the syndrome. And we can't break down precisely, you know, what's attributable to the vaccines, what's attributable to the depleted uranium, what is attributable to bombing munitions factories over in Iraq with chemical and biological weapons that spewed into the environment and contaminated our own troops. How much is attributable to pollution on the scene? And indeed, the Pentagon, before Gulf War I, had developed a computer model of what the environmental contamination would be if they went to war against Iraq with their bombing campaign and the rest of it, and they did it anyway. So it's a terrible situation. If you are interested more on that, there is a book by Rick Anderson, Homefront, the U.S. Government's War on Soldiers, Clarity Press. And I wrote the foreword to that book. So there's more on Gopher syndrome and the governmental denial and things of this nature. But it's all tied in there, and we first litigated this point for Captain Dr. Yolanda Hewitt Vaughn, even before we knew there was such a thing as a Gopher syndrome. In addition, I also served as a consultant to the independent television network in Britain, TV4, on their documentary, The Dirty War. And that came out, I believe, in March or so of 1994, first documenting the Gopher syndrome for British troops. And we dealt with the depleted uranium, the experimental medical vaccines in violation of the Nuremberg Code on medical experimentation, and the pollution and environmental contaminants. And I'm in there together with my my former client, Captain Dr. Yolanda Hewitt Vaughn. So those were early attempts to come to grips with Gopher syndrome. And unfortunately, the war going on now, we're going to have a repeat for U.S. soldiers currently serving in Gopher 2 under Bush Jr. You know, the anthrax vaccines are still given. To the best of my knowledge, they're giving the botulin vaccines. They've all been forced to take smallpox vaccines. They're still using depleted uranium. Some troops have already come back from Iraq and have tested positive for uranium in their urine. So I'm afraid we're in for a second round of Gopher syndrome on the current Gopher. And, of course, the Pentagon will still lie, deny, and cover up, as they did on Agent Orange in the Vietnam War.
Let's fast forward then to the Bush Jr. administration and BioShield and the biowarfare initiatives. And then most specifically, I want to talk about the events of September 11th, 2001, and the anthrax attacks on Congress. Now, did Bush Jr. step up the research and experimentation in biowarfare?
Yes. As a matter of fact, when Bush Jr. came to power, instead of going back and getting many of the Bush senior advisors, who generally speaking I think were against biological weapons, Bush Jr. reached back to the Reagan administration and brought back to power all the neocons in the Reagan administration who were in favor, again, of exploiting the U.S. technological lead on nuclear weapons and biological weapons, as well as chemical weapons. And so, for example, you had them junk the anti-ballistic missile system treaty, which again goes back to Nixon and Kissinger. We're not talking about liberal Democrats here. And proceeded immediately then to pull the plug, the Bush Jr. people, on the negotiation of the verification protocol for the Biological Weapons Convention. When it was originally drafted, there was no verification protocol for the BWC. Starting with Clinton, negotiations had commenced, and they really were at a concluding point when in the summer of 2001, the Bush Jr. delegate went in there and just said, we're against any verification protocol. And they came up with a cock and bull theory about why they were against it. But the truth was they fully planned to get into research, development, testing of biological weapons, again, using U.S. scientific superiority, not only on DNA genetic engineering, but also now so-called synthetic biology. So if you're going to do this, you don't want a verification protocol to figure out what you're going to do. So they proceeded to junk the verification protocol in the summer of 2001. And then they used the anthrax attacks on Congress after September 11th to literally justify, you know, since then, about $40 billion, if you add up all the different divisions of the government, on biowarfare and chemical warfare research. We're spending as much now on this reprehensible type of death science, I would call it, as we did when prior to Nixon, when we had an offensive program. Indeed, we're spending as much now on biowarfare research in constant dollars as we did on the Manhattan Project during World War II to develop the nuclear bomb. So that's where we stand now.
Dr. Boyle, could you speak to the specific strain of anthrax that was used on the Democratic leadership in Congress after September 11th, 2001? That is for Tom Daschle and Patrick Leahy received in letters this Ames strain. I believe it's called anthrax. Could you talk about where that anthrax came from?
Well, yes. What happened was when the anthrax attacks occurred, it was not clear to me precisely what was going on until the New York Times published the technology behind the Daschle letter. And that was a trillion spores per gram, and it had a special electrostatic treatment, so it basically float in air. And it was clear then that this was a super weapons-grade anthrax that no one would have the capability of doing except a government program. And here in the United States, that would mean either the Pentagon or the CIA or both. And it was also clear by that time that the book Germs had come out by the reporters for the New York Times indicating that the CIA had gotten involved in this type of research before. So at that point, I called up Marion Spike Bowman, who was a very high-level FBI official in Washington, D.C., doing terrorism and counterterrorism work for the FBI. And he knew of my work on biological weapons. And I told Mr. Bowman that, in my opinion, this could only have come from a U.S. lab, weapons lab. It was super grade weaponized anthrax and had to have been produced by someone with access to a U.S. lab, probably in one of these moon suits you've seen on, films and things of that nature. And I explained to him my conclusions. And, he said he'd take it down and forward it to the appropriate people. Then I called him a second time, and I said, in fact, I have here a listing of all individuals involved in anthrax research for the United States government up until 1989, as well as all the labs. And at that point, it was a matter of public record. And I said, it seems to me that the culprit here is one of these individuals or the labs, and you can get an update on these contracts from the Pentagon. And also the CIA is involved in this now because of the book that just came out, Germs, and you could probably find out from the CIA who is involved in doing this type of work. So it's a very narrow list of people that you're dealing with. So Bowman said, well, actually, we're working with the people at Fort Detrick on this. And I said, well, Fort Detrick very well could be the problem here, that you could have someone at Fort Detrick who did this, or, someone who had worked at Fort Detrick and was no longer working there, but had access and was doing it. As I put it, it could be someone like a Timothy McVeigh character who was once on the reservation, is now off the reservation. So, Bowman said, well, I'll forward it on to the appropriate people. Shortly thereafter, of course, what happened was the FBI authorized the destruction of the U.S. government's anthrax collection at Ames, Iowa. And there's a government lab there at Ames, Iowa. And it was Ames strain anthrax that later was determined to be the culprit behind the Leahy and Daschle letters. So at that point, it just seemed to me there was no way that culture collection at Ames should have been destroyed it should have been preserved by the FBI as part of an ongoing criminal investigation. It was critically sensitive and important evidence, and they destroyed it. Now, I did not specifically tell them to preserve the Ames strain anthrax at the Ames collection in Ames, Iowa, but it was very clear that that's where all the U.S. anthrax, weaponized anthrax, went back to, and they authorized its destruction. So at that point, it just seemed to me that the FBI was covering up here, probably because they knew that the Daschle and Leahy letters went back to an illegal and criminal U.S. weapons-grade anthrax program, either run by the Pentagon or the CIA or both. And again, we're not sure where. And then later on, it came out in the Griffith book on 9/11 that Marion Spike Bowman was also the same high-level FBI agent who sabotaged the request for a FISA warrant into the Mousaoui computer up in Minnesota. As you know, you had FBI agent Rowley there trying very hard to get a FISA warrant to access Mousaoui's computer. And this was before September 11th. And it turned out, according to the Griffith book, it was Bowman who sabotaged that FISA warrant that could have prevented the attack on September 11th. Later on, Bowman was given a promotion and a decoration for his services. So you figure out what was going on there. Since that time, the FBI has not engaged in any investigation, realistically speaking. In fact, they've perversely gone out and tried to sign up as many reputable life scientists as they can as part of this investigation, and then made them promise to maintain their silence, that they can't really talk about it. And so many, many legitimate life scientists who I think believe they are trying to help out in good faith are silenced. So this led Senator Grassley, just a few weeks ago, to say he didn't think this crime would ever be solved, and certainly it's not going to be solved by the FBI. What we really need is Senator Leahy, certainly now the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and they tried to kill Leahy, to have open public hearings and call in FBI, CIA, and subpoena them, put them under oath, and start to ask them questions. But I can't say I'm terribly optimistic this is going to happen. So that's where we stand. And the terrible thing about the anthrax attack on Congress, as you know, Daschle and Leahy were holding up the passage of the USA Patriot Act, which basically sets up a police state here in America. And we know for a fact that USA Patriot Act, the draft done by Viet Dinh, one of these Federalist Society lawyers now teaching at Georgetown Law School, was sitting on Ashcroft's desk as of September 10. And we also know that Ashcroft, starting in the late summer of 2001, had been advised not to take commercial aircraft, so he was flying around on private jet aircraft. So once these anthrax attacks occurred, all of a sudden the Patriot Act goes through Congress. And then when the renewal of the Patriot Act came up last year, again, it was being held up, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, some white powder appears at one of the Senate office buildings. There's an anthrax scare, and the next day, the USA Patriot Act is renewed. So there is a pattern here at work, I think, that we can detect and watch and follow. So we need an investigation. But again, I'm afraid we're not going to get it.
I'm speaking with international law professor and author Francis Boyle. Today's show, Biowarfare and the Emergence of Police State America. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
So the Ames Culture Collection was destroyed by the FBI.
They authorized the destruction. They did not destroy it itself, but they told the Ames people to go ahead and destroy it.
Yes, and then FBI Mr. Bowman is given an exceptional performance award by the FBI. Senator Daschle and Senator Leahy, who were holding up the Patriot Act legislation, they were the ones that received the anthrax letters. Now, I would think that Congress would be holding an investigation into an attack on itself that, after September 11th, shut down all of Congress.
That is correct. You know, as I pointed out in my book, this was the most serious political crime in the history of the United States of America, shutting down down Congress. You know, even in the Civil War, they weren't in session. It wasn't shut down, but they came back. And there is no investigation going on that I'm aware of. And just recently, Senator Grassley said he doesn't believe this political crime will ever be resolved. Meanwhile, the USA Patriot Act has been renewed, and we're seeing all the police state Gestapo tactics that the Bush administration is currently engaged in and getting away with, and not being checked at all by Congress. And here I speak from personal experience. In the summer of 2004, agents from the FBI and the CIA Joint Terrorist Task Force showed up here at my office unannounced, proceeded to interrogate me for 1 hour, tried to get me to become an informant on my Arab and Muslim clients, which would have violated their constitutional rights and my ethical obligations as an attorney. So I refused to become an informant, and they put me on all of the United States government's terrorist watch lists. According to my lawyer, there are maybe five or six of them, and as far as he could figure out, I'm on all of them, every one of them. To give you an example, so last year I was flying in from a lecture in Malaysia. I landed at Chicago O'Hare Airport, and as I was getting off the plane, standing there right on the jet port were two armed customs agents inspecting passports, and they got my passport. They immediately took me into custody. And one of them said, well, we're looking for someone who is listed on the terrorist watch list with your name, but it isn't you. Well, how many Francis Anthony Boyles are there in the United States of America at all, let alone flying into Chicago O'Hare Airport? So that sort of gives you an idea, I think, that when I talk about police state Gestapo-type tactics, it is going on today.
Yes, it's going on as we speak. What do you, as an attorney, of course, they've passed all of these laws, the Military Commissions Act, etc. What do you think the likelihood is of martial law in the United States?
I think we're very close. You know, it's only a terrorist attack away. Everything is there. It's all in place. So they even have a list. I believe the FBI has a list. The summer of 2004, the part of the dragnet I was involved in was about 5,000 high-priority Arabs and Muslims and their supporters, including aliens and U.S. citizens. And so I believe that'll be the first list to go, those 5,000.
So if we are only a terrorist attack away from possible martial law here in the United States, it is very worrisome.
Yes, it seems clear to me, certainly, that we have to ask ourselves, what's the next step? As for the anthrax attack, I believe that, you know, that was deliberately orchestrated by either the Pentagon or the CIA or both acting together. Yes.
Now, in terms of the continuing production of biologicals and the genetic modification of biologicals, the aerosolization of them, which basically turns them into a weapon because these biological weapons are delivered by air, as you point out in your book. Now, this is proliferating all over the United States, isn't it, at universities, at private labs?
Yes, this is extremely dangerous. And indeed, I would encourage you all to go back and read Cy Hirsch's 1969 book on the offensive U.S. Biological weapons program in existence at that time, because basically we're reconstructing the entire thing today as we speak. And what you have now with these massive quantities of money are death scientists in the private sector proliferating this extremely dangerous technology into the hands of what can only say irresponsible people, and oftentimes third and fourth rate scientists who can't get legitimate funds from the NSF or the NIH or something like that. And it's going on all over the country. They're constructing Biosafety Lab 3 and 4 labs all over the country. And they are using these exotic viruses. There was already an accident earlier this week at the BU, Boston University BSL-3 lab that has anthrax in there, and there was a fire. So what we're seeing then is proliferation of the technology, of the scientists, and the facilities all over this country, in Canada, and indeed abroad. We're paying for this type of research, development, testing in other countries as well that are not even subject to minimal observation and restraints that do exist here in the United States on scientific research. Here at the University of Illinois, under the Reagan administration, we had the entire vet med program pretty much on the take from the Pentagon to develop a blue-green algae toxin weapon and a mycotoxin weapon. I got the contracts and blew the whistle. And it turned out that the head of the Pentagon's biowarfare program at the time, a guy named Huxley, was a graduate of the vet med program. And the cover-up was written. We have the U.S. Army's computer engineering research laboratory here on campus, and they wrote the cover-up. So this is going on, and I've read these contracts, extremely dangerous, and as I said, third and fourth rate scientific researchers, no adequate supervision at all. Indeed, these committees at universities set up for oversight and approval are worthless. That's what I found out here at the University of Illinois. I'm sure they're no different anywhere else. We had a debate on this issue, and the university sent someone in to admit that they got 51 cents out of every dollar on so-called overhead. So obviously they're complicit in all this, and they're not going to shut down these types of dangerous, if not illegal, contracts when they're making money off of them. So it's sort of like the Wild West out there now. There's no regulation, there's no supervision, and you have scientists with minimal ethical training or concern, and even those who do are being bought off because of the massive amounts of money. For example, the National Institutes of Health is seeing so much of their research now being diverted into biowarfare work. Prior to that, I think everyone had looked at the NIH as a rock-solid basis of support for research to maintain the nation's health. But now legitimate research is being starved. I spoke with a first-rate professor of biology here on campus, and he told me that now there's a 1 in 11 chance of him getting his contract funded by NIH. Everything's being moved over into this highly dubious, if not outright illegal, biowarfare work. And most agencies and instrumentalities of the United States government are on board and have been bought off.
I'm speaking with international law professor and author Francis Boyle. Today's show, Biowarfare and the Emergence of Police State America. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
Now, as you've pointed out in your book and today, a lot of these biological warfare programs are illegal and criminal. And you've also mentioned that there were 5 level 3 biowarfare labs in New Orleans when Hurricane Katrina hit. And we all know about the government's non-response there, or their prevention of help in New Orleans. You've written that we must defend ourselves against their criminality and irresponsibility with impeachment. Could you talk about impeachment?
Well, sure, but let me first say on the biowarfare work, I think citizens living in communities where the government is trying to put in biowarfare research, development, and facilities have to mobilize and organize to stop it. There is a requirement that they have to do an environmental impact statement on any of these facilities, and if they don't, you can sue to get one and inform yourself about what's going on and organize it against it, because otherwise you're going to have one of these facilities right there, and either something could leak out by mistake or some person could maliciously use the type of work that is going on there. So it has to be stopped on a state and local and community basis, everyone getting together. That's why I wrote this book, so that ordinary citizens can read it, understand the threat, and what they can do about it. And what we have to understand to begin with is the law is all on our side. We have the Biological Weapons Convention, and we have the Biological Weapons Anti-Terrorism Act of 1989 that I drafted, providing for life imprisonment. So those are two very powerful pieces of law that people can use to try to stop this heinous death science research and to keep it out of their communities. And they're going to have to do it themselves everywhere all over the country to try to stop it. Inform yourself who's doing this, how much are they getting, what do these contracts say, what do they mean, and then proceed to organize to stop them. As for the bigger problem, yes, back in October of 2002, I set up a national campaign to impeach Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, and Ashcroft at that time. And on 13 March 2003, Congressman John Conyers, now the chair of the House Judiciary Committee, with supervisory jurisdiction over any bill of impeachment, had an emergency debate among 40 to 50 of his top advisors, most of whom are lawyers, on putting in draft bills of impeachment immediately against Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, and Ashcroft to try to head off Gulf War II. And I had drafted a bill towards that end. And my colleague and friend Ramsey Clark had also drafted a bill. I think he began working on that in January of 2003. So Congressman Conyers invited Ramsey and me to come in and argue the case for impeachment and putting these bills in. To make a long story short, it was a two-hour debate. It was quite vigorous. You can read about it in my book, Destroying World Order. But what happened was no one there really disagreed with Ramsey and me that Bush and the rest of them richly deserved impeachment. But what happened was John Podesta, who had been Clinton's chief of staff, appeared and in the name of the Democratic National Committee stated that the DNC was against putting these bills in because it might harm their presidential election prospects in 2004. Now, that was a shocking statement for Podesta to make and for the DNC to be taking. Here we were confronting a war, and they were worried about the 2004 election. Now, I'm a political independent, so I didn't argue that point one way or the other. But Ramsey's a lifelong Democrat, and he argued that putting in these bills of impeachment immediately might help the Democrats, and it certainly wasn't going to hurt them. Well, of course, as we know what happened in 2004. But on the way, when the session adjourned because the Podesta position prevailed, I was walking out with Ramsey to get our cabs back home. And I said, you know, Ramsey, I don't understand it. Their arguments make no sense. Why didn't they take me up on my offer to stay here and polish up our bills of impeachment and put him in immediately to try to head this war off. And Ramsey said to me in his laconic style, I think most of the people there support a war. So what we have to understand is that the leadership of the Democratic Party has been complicit and supported the Bush war against Iraq from the very beginning. And indeed, we have that today itself, where the U.S. House of Representatives, under the leadership of Pelosi, just voted over $100 billion for more war. They make all these spurious claims about how this is going to get us out of Iraq, et cetera, et cetera. It's all baloney. They just voted $100 billion more for this war. All they had to do was do nothing, and Bush would have run out of money to fund his surge and to continue to fund this war. So despite the smoke and mirrors by the leadership of the Democratic Party, it's clear that they are fully on board. The DNC fully supports the war against Iraq. That was clear, made clear to Ramsey and me on 13 March 2003, and nothing has changed.
So to sum up then, with regard to these biowarfare labs, there are chapters in your biowarfare and terrorism book that help people fight these labs.
That's correct. That toward the end of the book, you know, I'm a lawyer, I'm a law professor, last 30 years now, and so I tried to give advice to common, ordinary, everyday citizens about what they can do to try to stop these biowarfare labs and facilities and contracts, and to go after these death scientists who are doing this type of illegal and criminal research. But it's really up to you to inform yourself. Here, for example, I found out about our biowarfare programs at the U of I and submitted a Freedom of Information Act request under the Illinois Freedom of Information Act. My guess is you probably have one out there in California, and found out about these contracts, got a hold of the contracts, found out what was going on, blew the whistle, and, you know, we were able to nip these things in the bud. So you have to stop them now, before they get entrenched, before you end up with a BSL-3 or BSL-4 lab there in your neighborhood and 15, 20 so-called death scientists researching Ebola down the street. Because if you don't act now, that's exactly what you're going to have. And most of these scientists are completely unscrupulous. The respect we have for scientists, in my opinion, certainly dealing with the biological sciences, is completely unwarranted. Most of them just go for the highest bidder, a buck, and don't care about the ethics. They've been brainwashed in their science programs to believe that science is neutral, and therefore it doesn't matter what you do with it. I was at the University of Chicago. I started as a math major and then went into population biology. I've been through the same type of brainwashing myself. There's nothing neutral about science, nothing at all. And we cannot treat any of these scientists as if somehow they're priests or ministers above reproach. We have to hold them accountable. And that's exactly why I drafted the Biological Weapons Anti-Terrorism Act and put life imprisonment in there to make it clear to all of these death scientists that they had better think very carefully about getting involved in any of this type of work. So the book is set up to be used because the Bush people are putting billions and billions of dollars in this, and the scientists are more than happy to be bought off and get involved.
Francis Boyle, thank you very much.
Well, again, thank you for having me on, and I hope that book can be put to good use to stop this.
Something happening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
I've been speaking with international law professor Dr. Francis Boyle. Today's show has been Biowarfare and the Emergence of Police State America. Francis Boyle is professor of international law at the University of Illinois Champaign. He holds a doctor of law and a PhD in political science from Harvard. He was responsible for drafting the Biological Weapons Anti-Terrorism Act of 1989, the American implementing legislation for the 1972 Biological Weapons Convention. He is author of Destroying World Order, U.S. Imperialism in the Middle East, Before and After September 11th, and Biowarfare and Terrorism, among many other books. On October 7th, 2002, Dr. Boyle launched a national campaign to impeach Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, and Ashcroft for high crimes and misdemeanors. Today's show was co-produced by Todd Fletcher. Guns and Butter is edited and produced by Bonnie Faulkner and Yara Mako. To leave comments or order copies of the show, call 510-848-6767, extension 628. Email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.net or visit our website at www.gunsandbutter.net.
You know what I'm saying? Now the question is, are you ready for the real revolution, which is the evolution of the mind? If you seek, then you shall find that we all come from the divine. You dig what I'm saying? Now if you take heed to the words of wisdom that are written on the walls of life, then universally we will stand, and divided we will fall, because love conquers all. You understand what I'm saying? This is a call. So wake up and take control of your own cipher, and be on the lookout for the spirit sniper trying to steal your life. You know what I'm saying? Look within yourself for peace. Give thanks, live life, and release. You dig me? You got me?
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Can we get rid of our country's and our culture's militarism? We have to, but boy, it won't be easy. So says Stan Gough today, and 50 years ago, so said Martin Luther King. I hope you'll stay tuned. January is about over, and we shouldn't let the month go by without at least mentioning Martin Luther King. When I think of King's life, what sticks in my mind is not his struggles of the 1950s, early 1960s for integration. Not the Montgomery bus boycott, not the letter from the Birmingham jail, not the I Have a Dream speech, not the struggle for voting rights, important as all those things were. What really impresses me, though, is when King went beyond those earlier struggles, when he saw that it wasn't enough to focus on voting rights and fair housing and integrated lunch counters. When he saw that black Americans, and most white Americans too, would see little real improvement in their lives until they had beaten the twin 600-pound gorillas in the room. These twin gorillas are ruthless, exploitative American capitalism and the U.S. war machine. I call them twin gorillas. More precisely, they are twin gorillas joined at the hip. This is my metaphor, not King's, and I'm probably not being fair to gorillas. But to return to King, this broadening of his concerns came in the last year or so of his life. The change was marked by his great speech against the Vietnam War, given at Riverside Church, New York, on April 4, 1967. At the time, he was also working on organizing a massive Poor People's March on Washington, D.C. And what was he doing in Memphis on April 4, 1968, when he was assassinated? He was speaking in support of striking garbage collectors who were demanding a fair wage. In sum, not integrated lunch counters, economic justice, and an end to military aggression. When King took on the Pentagon and the rest of the national security state, and also took on the oligarchs of the economy, he quite lost the support of the white establishment. The establishment didn't really mind this non-violent Christian confronting the occasional Southern sheriff. Doing that didn't threaten the elite or hurt the Dow Jones average. And doing that did help draw oppressed black people away from the more radical and dangerous organizations, such as the Communist Party, the Black Panther Party, the Nation of Islam. So the white establishment didn't have any serious problems with King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference and its nonviolent demonstrations. But when King began denouncing the country's current war of choice and actively campaigning against wage slavery, well, that kind of nonsense is bad for the empire, bad for stock portfolios. So King was killed in short order. So in his last year, King opposed and confronted two major predators, predatory capitalism and the predatory U.S. war machine. The past 2 weeks, we've been hearing about capitalism. This week, then, let's focus on the war machine. We'll hear from former Special Forces Master Sergeant Stan Gough. First, though, let's hear from Martin Luther King himself. Here's about 4 minutes from his great anti-war speech at Riverside Church, April 4, 1967. This was 1 year to the day before his assassination. The speech is titled Beyond Vietnam. In this passage, King discusses why he, as a civil rights leader, was obliged to shift his gaze beyond voting rights and housing rights towards the broader problem of militarism and national priorities.
Tonight, however, I wish not to speak with Hanoi and the National Liberation Front, but rather to my fellow Americans. That is, at the outset, a very obvious and almost facile connection between the war in Vietnam and the struggle I and others have been waging in America. A few years ago, there was a shining moment in that struggle. It seemed as if there was a real promise of hope for the poor, both black and white, through the poverty program. There were experiments, hopes, new beginnings. Then came the build-up in Vietnam, and I watched this program broken and eviscerated, as if it was some idle political plaything of a society gone mad on war. And I knew that America would never invest the necessary funds or energies in rehabilitation of its poor so long as adventures like Vietnam continued to draw men and skills and money like some demonic destructive suction tube. So I was increasingly compelled to see the war as an enemy of the poor and to attack it as such. Perhaps a more tragic recognition of reality took place when it became clear to me that the war was doing far more than devastating the hopes of the poor at home. It was sending their sons and their brothers and their husbands to fight and to die in extraordinarily high proportions relative to the rest of the population. We were taking the black young men who had been crippled by our society and sending them 8,000 miles away to guarantee liberties in Southeast Asia, which they had not found in Southwest Georgia and East Holland. So we have been repeatedly faced with the cruel irony of watching Negro and white boys on TV screens as they kill and die together for a nation that has been unable to seat them together in the same schools. So we watch them in brutal solidarity, burning the huts of a poor village, but we realize that they would hardly live on the same block in Chicago. I could not be silent in the face of such cruel manipulation of the poor. My third reason moves to an even deeper level of awareness, for it grows out of my experience in the ghettos of the North over the last 3 years, especially the last three summers. As I have walked among the desperate, rejected, and angry young men, I have told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles would not solve their problems. I have tried to offer them my deepest compassion while maintaining my conviction that social change comes most meaningfully through nonviolent action. But they ask, and rightly so, what about Vietnam? They ask if our own nation wasn't using massive doses of violence to solve its problems, to bring about the changes it wanted. Their questions hit home, and I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. For the sake of those boys, for the sake of this government, for the sake of the hundreds of thousands trembling under our violence, I cannot be silent.
Martin Luther King, Jr., April 4, 1967. Let us move now from the past to the present, from Martin Luther King to Stan Gough. Gough was a career soldier from 1970 to 1996, a master sergeant in the U.S. Special Forces, the Green Berets. He has also served as an instructor at the United States Military Academy. so he knows the army and he knows war about as well as anybody. He's a very sharp guy, and he seems to be a scholar, too. And he's become an analyst and a fierce critic of the militarism that pervades American society. For Gough, America's problem isn't just that the Pentagon has too much power and money. It's deeper than that. As Gough sees it, America has a national religion, worship of the nation-state. And in that religion, war is a central ritual. I'm tempted to say a sacrament. Not only in the U.S., but in Western countries generally. And this is nothing new. Gough traces the religion of the nation-state and its religious practice of total war back to the U.S. Civil War. So the problem is not just the Pentagon, it's our whole society. Many of our social institutions promote this religion of the nation-state and its sacrament of war. For example, the public school system, organized sports, especially football, Hollywood, the National Rifle Association, the Boy Scouts. For Gough, another cause of endemic militarism is our culture's warped concept of masculinity, which stresses violence. So many of our society's institutions are so closely intertwined with militarism that demilitarizing our society may be close to hopeless. So says Gough, and he's probably right. What he feels he can do is work with individuals, helping them critique what they see in the media, and especially helping them re-examine what masculinity means. That's pretty heady thinking for an ex-Green Beret. Quite a change in perspective. It's different in details, but also kind of similar to the change in thinking Martin Luther King underwent late in his life. Here is Stan Gough in a radio interview of April 2014. He starts out discussing why our culture venerates soldiers and veterans, why we call every guy who ever put on a uniform a hero.
I actually wrote a fairly substantial chapter in my last book, the one that's coming out, I think, around February, about when this started in the United States in particular, and it was back then the Civil War. Before that, people were very suspicious even of standing armies. And the Civil War, the American Civil War, was the first modern war, the first total war in a lot of ways. It was the first mechanized war. It was the first time that supplies were being moved by trains and communication was over the wires. And the first aerial reconnaissance balloons, the first submarines, the first armored battleships, all those things, the first time that machine guns were put into use, even though they were put into general use because of the smoke back then. And it was the first total war that was waged against the entire society. It was understood that the whole population was at war against another whole population. So in many ways, the American Civil War was the first modern total war. And Harry Stout wrote Funny Alter the Nation. It's a moral history of the Civil War. It's a very interesting book because what he shows is that here, a couple hundred years after disestablishment, after there was, you know, the end of Christendom, the end of the political power of the church in Europe and America, there was the emergence of the nation state as the political sovereign. And William Kavanaugh, a Catholic theologian, writes about this too. He calls it the migration of the holy. What happened was that the nation-state in the Civil War became sacred. It became the civic religion. And it took on all the aspects of a religion. You know, we had speeches that were dripping with religious imagery. And it's sort of interesting that if you think about going back to, say, the year 100, 200, 300 prior to the Constantinian shift in the church, the person who was most honored in Christianity was a martyr, someone who's willing to die, and willing to die for their faith. But with a civic religion, it's the person who's willing to die for their country. And that became not just willing to die for your country, but willing to kill for your country. And so that's, I think that underwrites the veneration a veteran, because there are plenty of people out there who take as many risks as veterans, more risk than most veterans. There are plenty of people out there that suffer from traumas, traumas as bad or worse than combat. There are plenty of people out there who contribute a lot more to society, but they're not venerated in the same way that veterans are. The only reason that veterans are venerated that way is that the veneration of veterans becomes the veneration of war, and war is the fundamental organizing principle of the nation. So war becomes part of the national liturgy in this civic religion. And you see, it is almost an article of faith. And that's, I think, why there's this sense of sacredness about it. The sacrifice of the soldier becomes much greater than any other form of sacrifice. And there is an element of intimidation. You know, you're a heretic if you question this. If you don't participate in the veneration of veterans and the veneration of soldiers, you are an outcast, because you're seen in exactly the same way as a heretic was seen in the High Middle Ages. I think that has a lot to do with it. This notion of a civic religion is really an interesting lens to kind of view this through, and it makes a lot more sense of why, you know, we have these parades and these flag wavings and all this, you know, we want to refer to every soldier, even if they were a flute and piccolo player in the Air Force band, as heroes, you know. That's where I think this stuff comes from. Ideology works in a peculiar way. It reproduces power at the same time that it conceals it. And the ideology of militarism is now more concealed. It's very difficult to convince people that we're a militaristic culture, because now that's no longer acceptable to call it that. Even though it is that, we can't call it that. So there's that concealment aspect. But if you go back to the turn of the century, around the time of sort of the rise of the popularity of Theodore Roosevelt, and around that time, there was a real crisis of masculinity, because the frontier had been conquered. So there was no place out for this masculinity to be proven. And that was actually one of Roosevelt's things. You know, they were afraid that citification, that the urbanization was making men weak. And there was actually a call for militarism. That was also the time when the United States was very aggressively seeking colonies. And the Spanish-American War was their first attempt to really reach out beyond their own borders and begin to establish colonial peripheries. So in that period, we see the ideology of militarism really take a hold, being promoted. And two of the things that it was promoted through, very intentionally at the time, now it just becomes kind of a recursive feedback loop in, you know, between the ideology and the culture, but at the time this was very intentional, was that were public schools were developed on a Prussian military model, and they were designed to discipline the population and make them more adaptable to a militaristic culture. And the other thing was the promotion of sports, in particular football. Now, when Jack Johnson defeated a white opponent in boxing, that Roosevelt actually called for the prohibition of boxing, because this was very much a white man's thing, this whole push to get through this crisis, or this so-called crisis of masculinity. But in fact, it was with the establishment of public schools, they also had military science, or what was then considered military science, which became ROTC, was integrated into the schools at the very beginning. At the very beginning. And the administrative structure, the management structure, and the execution, the organization of classes themselves were all done on a military model that was adapted from Prussia. So it's been there all along, and you do these things that were adapted from the military tend to promote an episteme of militarism? Of course they do, whether we recognize it or not, because we tend not to understand sort of the interpretive frameworks that we use, because since they are our interpretive frameworks, they seem natural to us. They seem like common sense. And that naturalization is one of the things that sort of conceals ourselves from ourselves, you know. But yeah, the school and sport definitely, and gun culture. After the Civil War, people became concerned that they had to fire 1,000 rounds to shoot one person. And so marksmanship became a big deal after that. And then an organization appeared to promote marksmanship that was very closely aligned with the military. It was called the National Rifle Association. And another thing, well, the NRA had another partnership at the turn of the century, and that was another organization that was designed to promote military virtues, and that was the Boy Scouts of America, which they actually adapted from the Boy Scouts of the United Kingdom. And they brought an advisor over from UK to help gun culture. You had Boy Scouts promoting bald militarism, you know, the same kinds of the uniforms and marching and earning awards and all that stuff was very militaristic, and football and public schools. So all those things together eventually became part of the culture, and these things, you know, ideology conceals power, but it also reproduces, and it started reproducing, it automatically reproduces those same virtues that are now identified as military virtues. I think that's it's very much in there, but it's not a conspiracy. It's just something that becomes self-organized. You know, society is a very complex thing, but it's also a thing that sort of runs under its own steam until something disrupts it. And so all these relationships become naturalized, and they end up setting up these same kinds of feedback loops between what we do and what we think and how we feel and how we understand things. And militarism is basically now in our social genetic code, for lack of a better analogy. A lot of people would love to know, how do we, whoever the we is, fix this, whatever this is, and I'm not altogether sure it can be fixed. But my own little niche in all this and trying to figure out how to intervene, how to deliver that dislocative jolt to people's consciousness about this is through the issue of gender, because I think gender is what underwrites militarism at a deeper psychological level, at a psychological level that is mostly invisible because these interpretive frameworks are naturalized. They are something that seem like common sense. I'm just not really sure. I think we just have to keep chipping away at this, you know, in every way we can and confronting this in any way we can. And I'm not at all confident that we, whoever we is, are going to fix it. War seems to be a way of life all over the world, and it has been for a long time, and it definitely does correspond to, well, to two things, and that's large-scale organization and patriarchy of any kind. War seems to be synonymous with those things in the evolution of various cultures, and now with weapons being available all over the world, it makes it much easier for people to try to settle the problems with armed conflict, but again, it's also partly because we're organized all over the world now as nation states. Modern nation states have one fundamental organizing principle in common, and that is the ability to defend their fixed borders. So war, or in the case of the more metropolitan nations, the ability to go beyond those borders and gain access to the inputs that they need in order to maintain a metropolitan way of life, which is done at the expense of global periphery. So it's built in. I mean, every time we start up our cars, every time we go to Walmart, every time we do, all of us are forced to be complicit because, again, the society is self-organized. We're forced to be complicit in myriad ways. The question then becomes, how do we find ways to withdraw step by step from our own complicity? And I'm not sure I have an answer for that beyond local solutions, because it seems like the big global problems have such mass and inertia now that even world leaders are only pretending to be in control. I think they themselves are captured by this inertia, and I'm just not sure. I'm not sure if there is like a magic wand we can wave over this and make it all go away. So I guess what I do is just try to appeal to people one person at a time, men in particular. That's my little shtick, is men in particular. Take a look at yourselves and see how many ways you're motivated by this probative masculinity that associates masculinity with violence and conquest. If we can get men to think more about that, then at least some men will learn how to not participate in those structures. And I think that's probably the best we can hope for. I think probably more valuable than turning our back on them would be for people who engage in more astute cultural criticism. Because going to one of these cinema nines or whatever, and seven out of the nine films will have a man with a gun and a fireball in the background up on the marquee. I mean, it's very much a cultural thing. But since we're going to be exposed to it anyway, we need to be exposed to it in a way that we learn how to be critical about it. And cultural criticism is very, very important. Susan Jeffords wrote an essay some years ago, back at the beginning of the Iraq War, called Telling the War Story, and she showed how by turning these things into stories about individuals, we can avoid looking at the larger structural issues that reproduce war. right now, the war is not something that is being produced for the same reasons now as it was 2,000 years ago. It's a different structure that's reproducing war. It's a different kind of war. So we don't want to essentialize war and then put it beyond our critical intervention. But by turning it into a story about individuals, this one, I forget what the name of it is, The Last Survivor or something that came out recently, was full of pathos, you know, because it was about this titanic struggle of this one individual to get through this terrible ordeal, and, you know, it made him very heroic. But by pulling our focus onto that war story, where we have the pathos of the individual character inside a story, it redirects our attention away from the structural conditions. It redirects our attention away from why was this person here in the first place? You know, what are the underlying historical trajectories that underwrite the war? Why did the United States feel like it had to invade Iraq? Why have we shifted since the Cold War all our attention to Southwest Asia and China? Why is all that stuff going on? People start asking those questions. Then power can be in trouble, or a little more trouble they're in right now, because then we begin to see what their true motives are. And I think that's the main thing that's concealed by ideology, are the true motives and the true reasons for why things are the way they are. I would like to see a constant and relentless deconstruction of just one particular genre of film, and that's the male revenge fantasy. It's the most insidious genre, in my opinion, and it's probably one of the most popular. But the male revenge fantasy, if every time a male revenge fantasy came out, we had an explosion of cultural criticism and an explosion of deconstruction around what was going on with that, I think it would open people's eyes. Why do we as an audience participate in it? Why do we cheer when Indiana Jones shoots the guy with the sword and casually walks away as if this man's life is worth nothing at all? Why does that become comic relief for the tension in the film? Why is that? And that deconstruction would be very helpful.
Stan Goff on why we need to end militarism and why it's so hard for us to do so. For Goff's words, thanks to Michael Welch, the Global Research NewsHour, and Station CKUW in sunny Winnipeg. I have condensed and edited the original recording. And thank you, too, for listening to New World Notes. On the web, we're at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, advising illegitimi non-carborundum. Remember that war is not healthy for children and other living things, and please come back again next week. Ciao.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake up call.
Well, it's a Taylor Report. It's CIUT and it's 89.5 FM, and we are joined by Mr. Tanzira. Are you there, sir?
Hi, Phil. How are you?
Very good. And, boy, we need you urgently today because I started to prepare my interview with you, and I was thinking of this, the conference, the peace conference, or whatever it's, the label is, that was taking place in Uganda, and then, and I guess they were to move to a second place to continue the meetings. Suddenly it all kind of went off the road, and we don't know when it's scheduled to resume. And there are a lot of noises off stage, discussions about the 5,000 Tanzanian troops, et cetera. So I guess we'll start with that. What is the status of these of this meeting, and what's your assessment of what happened in Uganda? We're talking, okay. Of course, I should remind her, this is about Burundi, where there has been violence, post-electoral violence, by armed groups in uniforms with high-powered weapons. And they've been so far handled by the Burundian police and military. But external powers have said, we ought to step in. And the people leading the charge are the African Union, based in Entebbe. So if I've contextualized it a little better, what do you think has happened in this effort to get the AU involved?
So there's two things. There's a dialogue in Kampala, Uganda, and there's the AU trying to send troops over. Mm-hmm. So as the dialogue, it was really shambles. It went terribly wrong.
Uh-huh.
So what happened here was on the end of last year, 2015, there were some talks held in Kampala. They're called peace talks, which were actually encouraged by the Security Council, the UN Security Council,
mm-hmm.
and the AU and the East African Community, as a way to ease tensions in the crisis in Burundi. And when the government went to Kampala, they were met with a trap because the people invited to the talks were really not the real, the players were expecting to meet at the talks. So, for example, SINARED, which is the violent opposition,
mm-hmm.
was being put up as the leader of the whole opposition. Now, the SINARED is basically, it's like, okay, I'll use America as an example. You have Democrats and Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
If there's a conflict here in America amongst parties, you want to have on the table Democrats and Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
But what they did here is they took the Tea Party, the extreme right Tea Party, and put them at the head of the entire opposition of the whole country. And I can tell you, as far as support and popularity, SINARED has no, they're really small, tiny parties who can never win elections in Burundi. Mm-hmm. And this is not new. For the past 5 years, they've been talking about transition system. They don't believe in elections, basically.
Mm-hmm.
To the point where there are two requests that this so-called opposition brought to the table. The first one was that President Pierre Nkurunziza should step down. And the second one was to amend an article in the Constitution. Now, I believe the article is 129 or 139,
mm-hmm.
which says that in order for you, your party, to be represented in government institutions, you must have at least 5% of votes during the primaries, mm-hmm. during the community elections.
Mm-hmm.
And that came to someone like me, an analyst, that is no surprise. These guys cannot amass even 5% at all.
Mm-hmm. So they need to get rid of that in order even to be players?
No, they want to be present. They want to be part of the government.
Mm-hmm. Oh, to be in the government. I'm sorry. Yes.
Yes, they want positions. without having been elected. Yeah. The way it works in Burundi, you get 5%, you get to be included in not only the government as far as ministries and cabinets.
By the way, that's a very liberal document. We don't have any such thing here.
Oh, yeah. It's power sharing.
Most people here are not in the running. They say forget it, go home.
Yeah. So that's one part of it. The other part is you also get a seat in parliament, Senate, and the House. So these guys, even in 2010, in the elections in 2010, they could not get the head of the opposition, Sinared, he could not even get 1%.
And yet they
He lost in his own hometown. In Africa, that's normal. You know, he lost in his own hometown in the 2010 election, and now apparently he's the most popular opposition person, according to...
And he's... Now, how does that little magic trick work? Who brought him there? Museveni brought him there, or the AU, or the EU? We got a bunch of U's here, okay. So I'll ask you.
Okay. The way I see the situation, clearly, it's the EU, and not even fully the EU. It's Belgium. Mm-hmm. Belgium. All this is run through Belgium. What Belgium has seen... They tried to prevent the elections. They failed. They cut aid against Burundi. They failed. They tried to take on Nkurunziza by supporting a coup d'etat, because it's kind of surprising that after the coup d'etat, a lot of the generals ended up in Rwanda and Belgium.
Somehow they were able to go into Belgium.
Oh, yeah, somehow they found visas quickly. And so they failed with that. And so right now, their last option that they're trying to do, Belgium, is to bring in an invasion force. Mm-hmm. The same way it was the African Union Peace and Security Commission that actually got the invasion force in Libya to take out Gaddafi. Mm-hmm. And that was through EU backing. Belgium really is pushing through this group of SNARED. And by the way, the government of Burundi, the reason why there was no more talks, follow-up talks for the 6th of January, is the government of Burundi yelled out and said, this is a trap. Because, number one, you don't tell us when to sit down and talk. Number two, the UN resolution that came out has, Article 2248 or something, that said that in the talks, the dialogue in Burundi, only peaceful stakeholders are welcome to the dialogue. It says that clearly, only peaceful stakeholders. The SNARED that have been put at the head of the opposition is the one that promotes violence. The same people who were part of the coup d'etat, the secretary general of that party, has been sanctioned by the U.S. because he's been training a rebellion in the Congo to attack Burundi. I mean, these are violent people. So according to the UN Security Council, the government said, we can't break the rules because these people are violent.
Well, by the way, it's so important, too, isn't it, to mention it, the way they are playing the stories, and it's overwhelming in today's news, and I do mean today, the 11th. They are creating this idea that there's inevitability about this AU thought or proposal. But, you know, they cannot do that without a UN Security Council agreement. The AU cannot invade somebody.
Yeah, so, okay, yeah, now that's the second part that the AU is trying to do. The AU tried to go to Burundi by force and send a military option, 5,500 troops, basically 7 battalions for a small city like Bujumbura. It's not even 1 million people. And it's just 3 neighborhoods that have all this this violence.
Boy, underline that. 3 neighborhoods is really the source of this, all this talk.
That's where what happened is during the failed coup d'etat, was some military battalions that were against the government went back into those neighborhoods and stashed a lot of weapons. Mm-hmm. Also, what was found out during by the prosecutor, the state prosecutor, they found out that many weapons had been stashed 2 years ago, coming in from Rwanda.
Mm-hmm.
So for years, these guys have been already stashing weapons, preparing, you know, for battle. They were never into the democracy, because they know that the ruling party is the party that kind of like people, the villagers see it as a party that bought back peace, and so they'll always vote for that party.
Mm-hmm.
So the other opposition, which is backed by a lot of elite from the previous government, they do not want democracy.
Yeah, and by the way, Mr. Buyoya was there, and he's living evidence of your point, isn't he? I mean, he was a general who at least twice, maybe three times, overthrew elected governments or popular governments.
He's done that twice. He's taken out, first of all, he's the reason why those the war that cost 300,000 lives, because him and his troops killed the first democratically elected president, and he took out another president after that in 1996. But he's right now he's at the top, and he works for the AU.
He works for the AU as a reward for his crimes.
As a reward for his crimes, he does work for the AU, and the AU sees nothing wrong about that.
This is Lebony Tazira, and I wanted, by the way. Don't you think we ought to maybe turn the tables? There's a slogan they use to invade people. They say, we don't want another Rwanda. But can't the answer be, we don't want another Burundi? Because it was Mr. Buyoya's troops that killed 300,000 people.
You know, I'll keep saying it time and time again. It's an insult to compare Burundi to Rwanda. It's like trying to focus on America's history, and we talk about Germany or Canada because there's white people.
Mm-hmm.
It makes no sense. Mm-hmm. Just because Burundi has Hutus and Tutsis and so does Rwanda, that does not mean that our history is the same.
Of course not. Yeah.
Far from that. And people who are doing that have a reason why they're trying to sell genocide.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Burundi, we had our own grave genocide, terrible genocide in 1972. We've had wars. Amongst ourselves, we've grown how to say, we learned how to say no.
Mm-hmm.
We've learned how to prevent ourselves from falling back to the dark times.
Ethnic fights. Yeah.
Exactly. Just the same way Germany went through a genocide and they taught themselves mm-hmm. how not to go back. Burundi is the same way too.
Yeah.
We've done that and people don't give us credit for that.
Yeah. It must be maddening. By the way, Lebony Tazira, of course, is a Burundian, a Burundian-American, but he's very conversant with all these issues. And two quick things. The people we're talking about, in the case of Buyoya, he is a longtime perpetrator, been involved in these. He's one of the people who wants you to go back. And the core of the violent people, aren't they the same people who always used violence 20, 30, 40 years ago?
Yeah. They're the same people trying to take out democracy again mm-hmm. because they're used to ruling through violence.
Mm-hmm.
This whole democracy system, power of the people, they don't like it because they say that it puts in people who are not qualified in power because Burundi has a lot of people who are not educated. So they're not making an expression,
by the way, American, many black Americans are familiar with that particular, and Latin Americans too, Latino, they're not qualified. You see, the quality of the service declines or some such
thing. Not only that. I mean, even the U.S. Embassy in Burundi, I got a hold over a wiki, the WikiLeaks?
Mm-hmm.
And the WikiLeaks talks about how the U.S. Embassy says Hutus are not qualified to be president. Burundi needs moderate Tutsi.
Well, I think I should please guide me to that, and I think we should post that on our site because that's very important. Now, lastly, there's an important matter. Today's stories, there seems to be an argument of what Tanzania said in a meeting in South Africa with the leader of the AU. on the question of the 5,000. Could you help us with that one?
Tanzania said they will support the troops. And here's the important line that has been taken out from the minister's comment.
Mm-hmm.
Only through consent of the government of Burundi.
That's an important detail.
It's very important. And also, I read his whole statement. He also said they do not support the mandate that was given to the AU troops. It's too robust. They would support a mandate through consent.
Mm-hmm.
A mandate that's like police, a police mandate, very weak mandate.
Yes.
The same way they had in Sudan, you know. Because
yes.
The mandate that the AU has authorized itself through Belgium
mm-hmm.
is a mandate basically to take out institutions. You have Louis Michel, the Belgian minister in the EU, who has said clearly he wants Nkurunziza out.
Yeah. Yes, we're back to this thing of diktat from a European power, because it's their interest, nobody else's, that they're caring about. They want what they want.
How do you want Burundi to accept troops when the people who are pushing for the AU troops behind the scene, and I know people who are in the AU, behind the scenes, this whole troops project was heavily pushed by two countries, Rwanda and Belgium.
Uh-huh.
Now, how do you want Burundi to welcome troops under a mandate that's being pushed by Rwanda and Belgium?
Yes.
And Rwanda has been accused, and there's evidence, of training a rebellion to attack Burundi.
Recruiting people out of refugee camps, which is a crime.
Yes. And
refugees
and finally,
are never to be armed.
And finally, the government of Burundi have, I think they heard it on your show, they've finally taken steps to denounce at the UN and at the AU to complain against Rwanda's actions of training refugees.
Yeah. Lebanon, I'm very grateful. This is the time we have for today, but you have really done exactly what we needed, an update that is to the hours. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you for having me, Phil.
Sure thing. That's Lebanon Tazira, and you're listening to the Taylor Report. CIT 89.5 FM. By the way, you go Taylor, Facebook / The Taylor Report, and our programs are available, we hope, by Thursday, and we'll try to include some of the documents referred to by Lebanon in this interview today. I hear you, Stephen. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. How are you doing, Sam?
Well, you're very close to the microphone. Thank you very much. Stephen, you're the man to tell us. What is the situation? Is it true that there have been victories, important ones, scored by the Syrian army in the area of Latakia, for example? Could you tell us where what you know of the developments in the war front?
Yes, the Syrian army and his allies on the ground with support from the Russian Air Force have advanced in the north suburbs of Latakia and took over the strategic town of Salma, that was the headquarters of the terrorist groups in the north suburbs of Latakia. It's in the hands of the army now, and the Syrian army is advancing, and now they are on the doors of the second biggest headquarters for the terrorists. And it's called Rabia. They might enter it tonight at dawn or tomorrow morning. Like in the next few days, it will have it. What happened in the last 24 hours that it looked like the Turkish got pissed off from the victories of the Syrian army, and they gathered thousands of terrorists from all over around the world, and they tried to push the Syrian army back. But thank God the Syrian army and his allies on the ground succeeded to push them back. And the Syrian army did not lose in the last 24 hours. Mm-hmm. Not one piece of land, not 1 meter. And it's really bad weather here. We're going through a storm, but that's not stopping. The temperature up there is -2 and -3. But Singa, yeah. But the Singa, the soldiers of the Syrian army, the home defense, and the other allies are really working hard, and they're fighting to defend Latakia from the terrorists.
Yeah.
From the supported by Turkey and the Gulf.
Now, there's a lot of press here about the town, the area called Medea. What can you tell us about that?
Medea is controlled by the terrorist groups that's supported by the Western countries as so-called moderate troubles. Hmm. In last of September, the Red Crescent entered big amounts of food and medicine to the city of Medea and to the two cities of Kafraya and Pua, who are surrounded by the terrorist groups. But what happened, the food that came in the two cities of Kafraya and Pua, they went straight to the people. But the food and medicine that went into Medea, the city of Medea, was all stolen by the terrorist groups and never given nothing to the people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what, yes, there is starving people in Medea. But why are they starving? Because the terrorist groups are stealing the food. The Syrian government and the Red Crescent are entering, and the head of the Red Crescent in Syria said this on an interview on Al Mayadeen TV channel. He said there shouldn't be any starvation in Medea. We entered big amounts of food and medicine in the end of September, and they entered food and medicine not so long ago. That what year is all that food going? It's being stolen by the terrorists. But what's happening? The Western media and the Gulf media, they want to make this into a sectarian thing, because the people, the soldiers on the ground who are for Hezbollah and the Lebanese resistance and the other resistance, they're the ones they're fighting, and the Syrian army, they're the ones who are fighting against the terrorists inside. So they want to make it into like a Sunni Shiite thing, but it's not going to work.
Mm-hmm.
Because look at the other side. You have Deir ez-Zor, the city of Deir ez-Zor. ISIS and so-called FSA have been surrounding it for the last 6 months. They're starving. The Syrian army are dropping food by the air, by the airplanes. And the Russians have been dropping food for them. Kafraya and Fua and Nipal and Zahra, those are four towns in the north of Latakia by Aleppo and Idlib. They've been surrounded by the terrorist groups for over 3 years and a half. Those have starvation. Why the media are not talking about them? Just because those people.
But by the way, also the larger issue, why do we have an embargo on Syria? It's very difficult even for the Syrian society to function and to have necessary supplies and medicine, food, when the U.S. it has an embargo.
That's true. Per dollar on the Syrian currency, per dollar is 400 Syrian pounds. It used to be every dollar 45 Syrian pounds. So it's a big fault on the embargo on Syria.
Now, what about there are talks scheduled for the coming up, the 25th, I think, they're supposed to meet. Do you think some of the sensational ones, like the one about Medea, which the Western media is trying to turn into an anti-Assad thing, do you think this is related to an attempt to prevent the talks or to undermine them or weaken the government position of the Syrian government?
In my opinion, that there is a side trying really hard for this talks to not happen. But as we can see in the Middle East, the situation is going towards peace. We saw the big deal between the Americans and the Iranians. We've seen today this morning the negotiation between President Putin and the Prince of Qatar after they've been, Qatar and Russia have been in bad situation politically with each other for over 5 years over Syria now. The negotiation have advanced between Russia and Qatar. Yesterday, the big deal between America and Iran has been done. So it looks like today in Lebanon also a big thing happened. Big deal happened about the presidency in Lebanon. It looks like the Middle East is going towards peace. It looks like the big players around the world, Russia and America, have made a deal to calm things down in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. That's what it looks like. So, and of course, all of that is going to have a big role on Syria, because Syria is the center of the Middle East. If Syria is not calm and Syria is not safe, the whole Middle East is not safe. Not the Gulf, not Iraq, not North Africa, nothing. The whole Middle East won't be safe.
Mm-hmm. Now, I was speaking to an earlier guest about the subject, and the U.S. had a plan, and they said that President Assad had to go, and they talked about regime change and all that. But what's your impression of the strategy seems to have run into a wall, and certainly the involvement of Russia is, I guess there's no other expression, it's somewhat of a game changer, isn't it? Do you get the impression that from where you're sitting, and you are in Syria, they are going to have to adjust to this setback, or are they going to try to come with a new plan for regime change?
The word regime change, it will not happen. Not if the American ones, okay? And not for the European or the Gulf one. As President Putin said, as the Syrian government said, that regime change, or let's say the change of the government, won't come by the Syrian people, by our country of constitution. The Syrian people, they're the one who is going to choose. So you have a Syrian government, you have a Syrian constitution, you have a Syrian army, you have the Syrian people backing all of that up. And you have good allies and loyal allies like Russia. So it looks like America's plan or America's game, or let's say, I'm not going to keep talking about the West, they're going to have to either change their plan and come close and sit on the same table with President Putin and make a deal that the Syrian people, they're the ones who are going to choose who runs and how they run their country, or we're going to stay in this, as the Americans say, in this fiasco for another few years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, Stephen Sahuni, we're very grateful you took the time, and it's a very encouraging account. Did you want to say something further? I'm sorry.
Yeah, I don't know if the Western media have heard of it, but the ISIS terrorist group have killed with cold blood 300 citizens, men and children and women, in the city of Deir ez-Zor, in the village of Al-Baghliya, and kidnapped 400, and their bodies were thrown in the river Al-Furat, and the river turned red because of their thing. It is one of the biggest and worst massacres that ever happened in this crisis. I don't know if the Western media are talking about this, but God bless their souls, and God bless the souls of everyone. And we just here in Syria asking the Canadian people, asking the Western people, pressure on your government, let us stop this war in Syria, because the Syrian people are people of peace.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a very important statement. Stephen, thank you very, very much.
Thank you very much.
Right. Bye-bye. Stephen Sahuni in Syria, Latakia, Syria. We're very glad we could talk to him because he's asking about the Western media, and that's a good question. We probably ought to have some. We'll look into that, see if we can develop a media in the West. The last story referred to this ISIS killing of civilians, which they're the ones who announced it, is another illustration of it. It's He puts the question, and I'm glad he raised it, but you notice that actually any story, no matter how bad or ugly, about ISIS and about the armed groups opposing the Syrian government, this always becomes an excuse to bomb by Western states without any authority, without the invitation of the Syrian government, with core coordination or acknowledgement that the Syrian government even exists. So what we need is to have a mental checkup of how we get into such a condition that we hear that a terrorist organization, mainly mercenaries, has killed Syrian civilians. And our answer to that situation is maybe we should bomb, but never coordinate anything or recognize Syria. And at the core of that is a policy that says that Assad must go and ISIS can be played with. And we see the bloody results.
You are listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
Building Bridges with Ken Nash and myself, Mimi Rosenberg. We begin by a terrible feeling I have of trepidation, but I hope that won't be validated by our guests. But January 11th, the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral argument from a conservative legal challenge targeting public sector unions. The justices of the Supreme Court have taken up the case brought by non-union teachers who object to having to pay for collective bargaining rights. The dispute pits 10 public school teachers and the Christian Educators Association International against the California Teachers Association, a union with 325,000 members and a history of backing liberal political causes. Unions that are certified to represent a group of employees are legally compelled to represent all employees in that unit, which means bargaining on behalf of all the workers for health care and other benefits, higher wages, and representing them in grievances to adjudicate their rights against their employers.
The dues pay for unions to be able to advocate for services to its members and to administratively function as an organization. This court challenge seeks a decision that would economically starve the public workers' organizations, affecting their ability to advocate for their members' individual economic benefits and their political rights as workers.
And we are joined now by Carolyn Fredrickson, president of the American Constitution Society for Law and Policy, and Joe Burns, labor lawyer and author of Strike Back, Using the Militant Tactics of Labor's Past to Reignite Public Sector Unionism Today. Public sector unionism has been one of the areas of growth, or at least stability, as the private sector unions have been hit hard, and their numbers and the numbers of workers who are represented have diminished significantly. So the right is going fiercely after the public sector unions. But we'll hear much more about that from Carolyn and Joe, but I want to begin by and ask Carolyn if this is an absolute red herring. So we are told that really what's going on here, this is a question of speech. It's a question of politics. Why should I, if I am in a bargaining unit and don't like the political positions, why should I have to give money to that union? It is, of course, we won't, maybe we will talk about what happens in terms of corporations that are people that have all kinds of speech now that nobody seems to inhibit. But so is that a total fraud? Is this nothing?
Well, it is. It okay. is a total fraud. I mean, there are people who don't want to pay for the political activities of the union don't have to. The fees that they pay are very restricted and go only towards the cost of the actual collective bargaining and the administration of the contract that the union is able to win. And so what, but basically the theory behind it is, as you articulated so well earlier, is that we, you know, a free rider issue is a big one. When workers are getting the benefits of what the union has done, which is get them higher wages and get them better benefits, that they should have to pay at least for the cost of maintaining that. They have no responsibility and can easily opt out of any of the political activities of the union. And as I said, it's very narrowly constrained what is even considered what they call chargeable by the union. That is, what can actually go towards these fair share fees and what has to be an additional requirement that the worker be a union member to support any other activity besides those. So the fact that these opponents of workers are raising this when it's clearly not in the case is just another way of really trying to cover up what's going on here, which is destroying one of the sole mechanisms that workers have now, which is to get together collectively and fight for a fair wage and fair benefits.
And Joe, paradoxically, it's the conservatives that are putting forth this, quote, free speech, end quote, argument. The liberals are talking about the free rider aspect of it, that the union has to represent all of the workers in the bargaining unit. You want to talk about that? And also maybe about Scalia, who seems to have turned on this issue.
Yeah, so basically in many states and in right-to-work states under federal law as well, the union is the exclusive representative of the group of workers. And as such, has legal obligations to represent those workers. So all of the workers are represented in collective bargaining. And in particular, if a worker gets disciplined, even if they're not a union member, the union has an obligation to have trained stewards who are going to represent that worker, take the case to arbitration if it has merit, which can involve thousands of dollars, union lawyers, and so forth. So there's a lot of financial obligations that the union has in terms of representing these workers. And what the law had been before, well settled, is that the union can, if someone opts out of being a member, they can't charge them for the blatantly political, you know, like campaigns and so forth, but for these core collective bargaining issues, they could charge them. Otherwise, these people are free riders and basically have an incentive to take the benefit and not pay for it. So that's kind of one component of it. And the other one that doesn't get talked about is as much is that, you know, the workers and unions, you know, traditionally have taken the decision that it should be a democratic decision. And if you vote to have a union in, then, you know, everyone should, you know, go along with the decision. Employers, in contrast, want to treat workers as a collection of individuals. And don't really want to respect us as a union or as a group and the decisions that the workers make together. And by allowing, you know, a minority to opt out of the – or not even opt out, not have to support the union when the majority has voted for it, it really weakens the union and the union's ability to make gains and to, you know, have a premium which has existed in the public sector.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think people have to realize that the right has taken the First Amendment, which I think most of us in the progressive world think is obviously a very good and important part of our Constitution, the right to free speech, but they have turned it on its head. And now the right to free speech is a right to bury opponents in money. If I'm richer than you, my voice is going to be that much stronger than yours. And that is where we've come from, you know, the whole set of cases involving Citizens United. So the First Amendment has become a sword in favor of reducing democracy in terms of reducing the ability to have a fair election. And now is becoming a sword to take down a vehicle for worker collective action. And let me just say there's that you know, we should talk a little bit about the sort of the history of this fair share fees. This is a very long-standing arrangement that the Supreme Court has approved for almost 40 years. Justice Scalia himself is on the record of upholding it in other cases. It's a commonsensical arrangement that the employers want. And so the issue of free speech here is a very minor one, ultimately, and the court has recognized in many other contexts that in the sort of the world of where the, you know, when the employer and the government are the same, you don't have the same rights in terms of free speech versus the government if it's your boss than you do if you're just a citizen, which makes sense, right? Because any employer has to have some ability to have some control over the workplace. That's normal. But what they're saying is that somehow the free speech argument is going to trump anything else that the government might want in terms of how it regulates its workforce.
Joe Burns, give us some context and background for this a carefully orchestrated attack. After all, this is settled law. I mean, once again, the Supreme Court is deciding to reconsider settled law. So what's really behind this? Give us some of that background.
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously the words of the Constitution haven't changed, so what has changed? You know, the political context has changed, the power of public employee unions has changed, and really created an opening for this attack. And I think it's important to see this not as a standalone constitutional issue, but really part of a political attack against public employee unions, which has been going on for quite a while, but, you know, in particular, the last, 8-10 years, it's really intensified. So this is part of the same process that saw, the Wisconsin Uprising was fighting against with Governor Scott Walker. It's what we saw in Michigan and, you know, other states, Indiana and so forth, and what's currently going on in Illinois with the battle that public employees are having with the Republican governor there. And it's really part of this idea that public employee unionism is illegitimate. And that's a battle that, public workers fought and won 50 years ago when the courts had these a lot of the same notions that public employee unionism was somehow suspect. So when I was reading through the transcript today and listening to some of the questions from the Supreme Court justices, it really sounded like arguments that were made, 60, 80 years ago, in the 1950s and so forth, where, you know, they view any bargaining, any sort of activity by public workers, in terms of bettering their working conditions as somehow political and taking away power from the, from the government and the politicians. And that's not a framework that public employees accepted in the 1960s and 70s.
Carolyn, I guess the only drama today was the question of which way Scalia would fall on this, because in the past he's taken the position that the free riders need to pay a fee because they're covered by the contract. Is everything came down fairly predictable as far as you're concerned in terms of the,
justices? I think people were hopeful that he would be consistent on this position, that the fair share fees are appropriate arrangement. He certainly didn't seem like that today, but I would caution the listeners from assuming too much from an oral argument, and that may be partly because I'm an optimist, but you really often don't know. Sometimes the justices really want to kind of get all of the toughest questions on the table. They want to be a contrarian. And so, and then there's a lot of work that goes on behind the scenes in terms of the members talking to each other, I mean, the justices talking to each other, and, they do some amount of dealing on how the decisions come out. And so, he definitely didn't seem very sympathetic today. which would be, you know, a reversal of where he's been in the past. But I guess I'm not ready to take that for a final answer.
Well, maybe if I can just push it a little, I'm more interested in what happened with Kennedy, who we have grown to see as more, quote, liberal, I use the word very advisedly, and of course this is the Roberts Court, and this has been a business-friendly court, and the Supreme Court now has a majority of its members who make their way to the court with corporate-funded conservative backing. So really, how are we to understand, aside from the specifics of this case, really what's happening with the court using this vehicle of worker organizations to support really the working class?
Yeah, I think Justice Kennedy was never one that people had a great deal of hope for, honestly. He may be liberal on issues around LGBT rights, or at least he's not hostile as some of the others are, but I don't think he's ever been much of a safe vote on issues around workers' rights. And so I don't think this is a terrible surprise that he also seems somewhat hostile today. It's just not an area where he's been very friendly.
Yeah, and I think it's important, you know, in terms of how you view the Supreme Court, if you view them as just some dispassionate individuals even-handedly in isolation interpreting the law, which I don't believe is correct, or whether you view them as part of an overall political process. And what's going on in this country right now is there is a concerted attack on public employee bargaining rights. They're trying to turn back the law, 50, 60 years. And, you know, they exist in this context. And if you look at the question of, in particular, union dues, conservative writers, really started focusing on this a number of years ago, like Fox News contributors writing books and so forth about the problem that they saw with unions having money and they wanted to cripple them. So, I think it all exists in a context, and, I would not be too hopeful about the outcome of this case, based on, just the trajectory of things, plus the specifics of the oral argument today. And I think there's also a concern about, where will they head from here? Because you can look down the road and, the logical extension of this, if they rule against agency fee here is then they'll start looking at the private sector and want to impose right to work upon the private sector as well. These conservatives are, they're relentless in their attack on union rights.
Yeah, I think the problem that really is a category failure on the part of, and purposefully perhaps, as I think was well articulated, that this may well just be part of a political agenda, but what the conservatives focused on was the idea that anything that happens in the public employment context is inherently political, and therefore everything is free speech, and that means that the free speech argument becomes much, much stronger than the way it had been approached in the past, which was to say, as I mentioned earlier, that the free speech rights of public employees are actually somewhat limited for all sorts of reasons, and that has been recognized in other contexts about what control the government can have over its workforce. And in that context, they have recognized that the government, if it favors this arrangement, can certainly prefer to bargain with one entity rather than have to have every single employee deal with each of them on their own grievances and wages and all of that. And so the issue really, that the conservatives focused on was how anytime there's any issue, whether wages now are not just an issue that are concerning of the workers, but are a public issue because, taxes might get raised or government resources are being used. And so they took it really out of the context in which it had been handled in the past and turned it into a discussion of how that the inherent political nature of everything that happens in the public employment context, which really stacks the deck against the workers, even though on first blush, and this is why it's such a clever argument, it might actually seem like it was pro-worker, right? Because you're saying, oh, it's their First Amendment rights. And in fact, what you're doing is allowing this small group of Koch brothers-funded individuals who are put forward and were hand-selected by these conservative activist groups to take away the rights of the vast majority of employees in order to advance this radical agenda that doesn't allow employees to actually bargain for their rights.
Joe, Justice Roberts said that the issue of free riders is insignificant, while Kagan has said that even union supporters would have a economic incentive to quit the union so that they could not pay dues. How detrimental would this be to unions, public sector unions, if this is upheld?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think what we've seen is that, you know, in states that, you know, they've changed the bargaining laws, we've seen, you know, some pretty good drops in union membership. Now, some of them, as in Wisconsin, were tied in with other initiatives, which also limited the union's ability to bargain over certain subjects and so forth. So, but I think, you know, I mean, I think, you know, the thought process behind this attack and the likely outcome will be a, you know, a drop in union membership. I think it's also important to remember that, you know, the agency shop and the, you know, dues collection is not what made unions powerful. They won that as part of an overall process of winning the right to strike and public employee unionism. So, you know, so in a sense, you know, this is really a symptom rather than the cause of labor's decline.
Carolyn, you mentioned the Koch brothers before. I didn't know if that was a kind of a metaphor for what they do in so many conservative causes, or is that the basis?
It's the reality. Yeah.
Could you tell us a little bit about the funding of this litigation?
Sure. Well, the Center for Individual Rights was is the main instigator of this, but behind them are the various individuals and entities that, you know, we've heard of as that fund, you know, they've funded the anti-affirmative action cases. They've funded the voting, the cases that have helped cripple the Voting Rights Act. And there's the Center for Individual Rights, which has been affiliated with and supported by the Koch brothers, the Bradley Foundation, the Olin Foundation, the Skype Foundation, and others, and it is really is part of an agenda that is about crippling the ability to provide the American people with any sort of social safety net, and that's what this goes after. And you know, this is the piece that goes after the public employees, because I would just say the public employment context is one that where women and workers of color have done better than any other sector in our economy. They have narrowed the wage gap. They have gotten better benefits. It's the sector that's most likely to have paid sick leave and vacation time and other benefits. And so, you know, it's an example that I think so many of us have been proud of where there have been successes. And much of that is due to the fact that the unions have been there and have bargained for better treatment of women and minorities and have erased the discrepancies between different categories of jobs. And so, you know, it's a target. It's been a target for the right. One of our successes is always going to be something that they're going to want to bring down, and that is what they're all about. So that's why these foundations, in particular, and the Koch brothers, are behind this, because this is such an important part of the progressive landscape.
Joe, you had mentioned that there have been periods of times when the public sector unions and other unions can make great strides, even if the law is against them. Do you want to give us a hint of what you're talking about there?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the ideas that came through from the Supreme Court were these discredited ideas from, you know, from the period leading up until the 1960s, where courts and judges and politicians deemed that
public employee bargaining was somehow illegitimate for many of the reasons that came out in the Supreme Court questions, that it was taking away power from the government, that it was illegitimate, that it was that public workers should not have collective bargaining. So, you know, collective bargaining rights were very few, and striking was outlawed in every jurisdiction of the country going into the 1960s. But public employees developed a conception of their own, and they viewed themselves as having equal rights with private sector workers, and that they should have the right to strike and collective bargain. And what they did in state after state is engaged in this great upsurge of illegal strike activity, and through that they won their unions, they won their contracts, but they also forced politicians and judges to change the law to allow for collective bargaining, to allow for the agency shop and so forth. And that's really how that was won, was through activism in the streets. So in many ways, you know, that'll have to be the future of public employee unions if these attacks continue.
And in the last 30 seconds, Carolyn, can you find some silver lining, or just for a way for us to persevere if some of the ominous signs do come true and we wind up with a negative holding from the Supreme Court on this very, very important case about the future of financing, certainly, public sector unions?
Well, that's a hard question, because I think it's just would be a terrible outcome. But let me just say that the one positive note that I've heard from people within the unions is that they're really getting back to basics in terms of making sure that they're doing the best possible internal organizing. But I think, as we've all recognized, you know, human nature is what it is, and if you can get something for free, you're likely to do that. So they're going to try and put their nose to the grindstone and make sure their own members are as enthusiastic and informed about the benefits of union membership, and try and keep them involved and keep them as paying members. But, you know, as I said, that's going to be a harder lift in the new environment. But that's what we're going to work for. And if not, then I think, you know, perhaps they're going to take it to the streets, as my colleague here on the air has mentioned.
Well, thank you, Carolyn Frederickson, president of the American Constitution Society for Law and Policy, and Joe Burns, labor lawyer and author, and encourage people to do read Strike Back, Using the Militant Tactics of Labor's Past to Reignite Public Sector Unionism Today. We need it more than ever. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Right. Thank you.
Great being on.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
My mother used to say, nothing for show. So what happened?
I wind up in show business. Confidential magazine was coming out on a story on me when I'd been arrested, like when I was 16 or 17 years old, for being at a party that a bunch of guys were at that were dancing together. You know, you might have called it a gay party, but that word wasn't around in those days. They said we have to tab you something, so that's how tab came about. You know, I'm a firm believer that somewhere under the pile of crap, there is a pony. Go for it.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucy Chappell. Marriage separates Episcopalians from the Anglican Communion, FIFA fines five countries for their homophobic fans, and Tab Hunter's pride on screen and off. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Christopher Gall.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending January 16th, 2016. The Episcopal Church, the U.S. wing of the British-based Global Anglican Communion, remains steadfast in its support of LGBT people and marriage equality after its theological brethren punished it for sticking to those positions. In a decision that seems to have prompted the disciplinary action, the top Episcopal legislative body, called the General Convention, voted overwhelmingly last year to authorize church wedding ceremonies for lesbian and gay couples. Anglican leaders meeting this week in England stripped the Episcopal Church of any role in deciding doctrine or determining how the 85 million member Anglican Communion operates for the next 3 years. That action essentially reduces the U.S. branch of Anglicanism to observer status. The Episcopalians ignited a rift in the communion that's been simmering for more than a dozen years since it consecrated openly gay and partnered New Hampshire canon Gene Robinson as bishop in 2003. The theological divide pits biblical traditionalists in the global South, primarily in Africa, Asia, and South America, against more progressive branches in Europe and North America. The disciplinary decision described the U.S. Church's wholehearted embrace of LGBT members as a fundamental departure from the faith and teaching of the Anglican Church.
The Episcopal Church's presiding bishop, Michael Curry, told the Associated Press in a telephone interview on January 15th that his fellow Anglican leaders recognize that there will be no change, saying that they basically understand we made our decision and this is who we are, and we are committed to being a house of prayer for all. Archbishop of Canterbury Justin Welby, the titular leader of the Anglican Communion, had organized the gathering to help avoid a widening split in the fellowship, but he does not have the authority to force a resolution of the conflict. The Anglican Church of Canada is scheduled to vote in July on a proposal that would also allow church marriage ceremonies for same-gender couples. Canadian Archbishop Fred Hiltz, who attended the Canterbury gathering, said the penalty assessed against the Episcopalians would probably influence his church's decision. Traditionalists in the Global South were generally supportive of the sanctions against the Episcopal Church, though some complained that the punishment wasn't severe enough, and that there was no what-if discussion about what would happen at the end of the three-year suspension. Anglicans trace their roots to the Church of England. They are the third largest grouping of Christians in the world, behind Roman Catholic and Orthodox churches. About a quarter of the Anglican Church's membership now lives in Nigeria.
Elsewhere, a Change.org petition is circulating among pro-equality Russians to protest a proposal in the nation's legislature that would criminalize coming out. Under a newly percolating bill, anyone who self-identifies as LGBT or is affectionate with a same-gender partner in public can be fined and jailed for up to 15 days. The Change.org petition, which already has more than 10,000 signatures, calls the proposed law unconstitutional, discriminatory, and anti-human. It deplores a 2013 law, strongly supported by President Vladimir Putin, that prohibits exposing minors to propaganda of non-traditional relationships, which the petition says has led to an increase in anti-LGBT aggression, including murders, and has strengthened homophobic attitudes in society. The bill's authors, Ivan Nikichuk and Nikolai Arefyev, say their proposal only targets gay men because lesbians are more reasonable and can manage their emotions. Nikichuk told the Russian news service that the so-called no-promo-homo law passed in 2013 did not go far enough.
We have our own idea of honor and conscience, and we must respect tradition, he said. The scum that comes to us from the West is unnatural to Russia. These unconventional sexual desires do nothing but disgust normal, smart, healthy people.
Speaking of Western scum, David Mundell, Scotland's Secretary of State, became the Scottish Conservative Party's first ever openly gay cabinet minister on January 13th. He wrote on his website that coming out was the only way he could be truly happy. The 53-year-old divorced father of three now adult children described the conflicting emotions and internal conflicts he experienced in coming to terms with his sexuality, but said that there was an unstoppable direction of travel towards the conclusion that he's gay. Mundell has won cross-party praise for his public declaration and said that he's received love and support from his family and friends. He said he hoped people would not treat him differently now that his sexual orientation is known, and ended his website announcement by writing that gender and sexuality should make no difference whether you are a cabinet minister or in any other walk of life, and I hope that I can, in my own way, reinforce that message.
Meanwhile, a court in Lebanon has ruled that a transgender man who had undergone reassignment surgery can legally change his gender to male in the nation's civil registry. Judge Janet Hanna of the Court of Appeals of Beirut overturned a lower court decision that had denied the man's request, saying she had weighed his health and well-being in allowing the change in official records to take place. She outlined three fundamental rights in her ruling: the right to change gender to relieve psychological and social suffering, the right to access treatment for gender conditions, and the right to privacy. The judge apparently issued her ruling in September, but according to local media and LGBT activists, the decision was only made public late this week. Tarek Zaiden of Helem, a Lebanese LGBT rights group, told The Washington Blade's Michael K. Lavers that Hanna's ruling doesn't change any laws in the Middle Eastern country, but Zaiden said it was nevertheless unprecedented because it addressed the right of the person to have respect and the right to have a private life.
But two men were arrested in Morocco on January 7th after a video of them kissing went viral and prompted expressions of outrage on social media. It shows two silhouettes smooching inside the classroom of a high school. According to a local news website, the men are friends and university students, and another friend shot the video. What the North African country's penal code calls acts of sexual deviancy are punishable by a fine and up to 3 years in prison. A verdict in the swiftly prosecuted case is reportedly due at any time. Three Moroccan men each received the maximum sentence for sexual deviancy in May 2015.
In other news, FIFA has fined Argentina, Chile, Mexico, Peru, and Uruguay for homophobic chants by their national team's fans. According to a January 13th media statement by the world governing body of football, called soccer in the U.S., the insulting and discriminatory chants came during qualifying matches for the 2018 World Cup. Chile got the biggest fine, equivalent to about $70,000, over cases at four different matches. The other countries were each fined about $20,000. FIFA said that proceedings continue against Honduras for apparent homophobic chants by its supporters. The organization's disciplinary code makes any national association liable for improper conduct by its fans, including uttering insulting words. But football's governing body has admitted that financial penalties alone will not rid football of homophobia. It remains to be seen if this week's penalties put an end to the offensive chants. FIFA has already taken heat for choosing the repressive Persian Gulf nation of Qatar, which is ruled by a powerful monarchy, to host the 2022 World Cup.
Just this week, Qatar banned the multi-award-nominated movie about early 1920s trans pioneer Gili Elba. The Danish Girl, which profiles one of the first identifiable recipients of gender reassignment surgery and stars Oscar winner Eddie Redmayne, was shown in the capital city of Doha on January 14th. But further screenings were canceled as soon as government authorities issued the edict against it. According to local reports, there were several comments on social media condemning the film. One complained about its moral depravity. The country's culture ministry announced quickly in a tweet late this week that the screening of the Danish film is now banned from cinemas. We thank you for your unwavering vigilance. Homosexuality is illegal in Qatar, punished by up to 7 years in prison. Muslims can be sentenced to death. Trans people have no rights at all in Qatar.
But finally, multi-award-winning U.S. TV talk show host and proudly out and partnered lesbian Ellen DeGeneres had a special announcement this week during her weekday afternoon telecast. The hit show, which started in 2003, features a daily mix of Hollywood guests, topical comedy, and upbeat conversation. And since it's Ellen, LGBT issues are regularly part of her showbiz agenda. Ellen has already won 55 U.S. Daytime Emmys, including 9 for Outstanding Daytime Talk Show, and attracts almost 4 million viewers. And of course, since it's Ellen, her big announcement this week quickly took a comedic turn.
You know, we've been working on Get Ellie on the Telly. Today is the first day we're airing on ITV2 in Great Britain. So welcome to all my viewers across the pond, and throw another shrimp on the barbie, mate.
That's News Wrap for the week ending January 16th, 2016. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Christopher Gall.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
This is Greg Gordon with an update to that News Wrap story about a bill in Russia to outlaw coming out. Reports on January 18th suggest that the proposal has been rejected in a legislative committee. We'll have more on this developing story next week.
This is Bishop Gene Robinson, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine.
It's time we get away to the movies and magic.
Our annual review of queer movies and television has morphed into a blockbuster interview double feature. So don your Hollywood shades for our multi-award-winning entertainment reporter's exclusive tour of the lot with Tab Hunter. The Psy Guy talks about his long and varied career, including a cult classic collaboration with his partner of more than 30 years, Alan Glazer.
Hello, I'm Steve Pride, and this is Pride on Screen for the year we just left behind. But rather than the usual countdown of my 10 fave flicks, this year it's a sit-down with two fave film folk. In the first part, it was film distributor Kathy Wolfe. This week, it's legendary film star Tab Hunter. One of the best documentaries of 2015 was Tab Hunter Confidential, based on Tab's memoir of the same name.
When I count three, will all of the ladies in the audience please go,
"Hmm." Are you Tab Hunter?
Yeah.
I think I've died and gone to heaven.
How do you shave, Tab?
With a Gillette Super Speed, of course.
What do you like about Tab Hunter?
Well, it's quite a few things.
Don't you ever think about marrying?
All the time, Ernie. That's what keeps me single.
Hello, I'm Tab Hunter, and I've got a secret.
My name is Tab Hunter.
I've heard of you.
I've been around a long time.
Well, let's start at the beginning because this is a big life. You had a really rough childhood.
I had a very abusive father. He was very abusive to my mother. And she left, took my brother and myself from New York to San Francisco. So we spent the first few years of our lives up in the Bay Area.
What was she like?
My mother was a really strict, religious German woman. She didn't put up with nonsense. She was a very serious person, and she kept telling us all the time, what you learn, no one can take away from you. And she pushed education, 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 because it's everything. She worked like a dog to keep us going to private schools.
Your mom had a saying about being showy.
My mother used to say, nothing for show. So what happened? I wind up in show business. She never liked the Hollywood hoopla. She only did one or two interviews in all the time that I was in the movies. It just wasn't her thing. She wasn't comfortable with people being in the public eye because it was too much adulation. And she said people have got to learn to divorce themselves from themselves.
I was surprised to find you were very shy.
Extremely.
How did you become an actor?
I was at a stable. I had a job out there on the weekends. I was about 14. And Dick Clayton, he was an actor, And he came out to the stable with Anne Blythe and was doing a photographic layout with her. And I used to see him out there all the time riding, and we struck up conversation, and I knew he was an actor, so I kept asking him a lot of questions. And he said, if you're really serious, you should think about doing that. And he was the one who, when I was in New York underage in the Coast Guard, he got me tickets to see my first Broadway show. He was the one who kept planting the seed all the time. You've got to work. This is not something that you fall into.
I guess your first big break was being signed with Rock Hudson's agent, Henry Wilson.
Dick Clayton introduced me to Henry Wilson, but he told me, he said, beware of Henry, because Henry's reputation is kind of strange, so I just think you should just be aware. And I was. Henry was a fairly good agent, but I left him when Dick Clayton became an agent because he was part of my family. My mother knew him, my brother knew him, I knew him. I mean, he's a great person. And Henry was so upset by that. That Confidential magazine was coming out on a story on Rock Hudson, and he gave them a story on me when I'd been arrested, like when I was 16 or 17 years old, for being at a party that a bunch of guys were at that were dancing together. You know, you might have called it a gay party, but that word wasn't around in those days.
Henry Wilson liked to change his client's name. How did Art Galeen become Tab Hunter?
Well, they said we have to tab you something, so that's how Tab came about. And I showed horses, hunters and jumpers. So they picked Tab Hunter as opposed to Tab Jumper.
So you became Tab Hunter, and then what?
The first big film I had was an independent called Island of Desire with Linda Darnell. I did a test with Linda, and then I went off to Jamaica, and we did it in Jamaica and London, and I was terrible. I mean, really, really bad.
But you improved. Just a few years later, you beat out James Dean and Paul Newman for the lead in Battle Cry.
Merv Griffin, Marilyn Erskine and Merv and I were out having dinner one night, and Merv said, I've just read a book called Battle Cry, and I think you'd be perfect for Danny Forrester. You should have your agent check on it. So I immediately bought the book, read it, reminded me of my brother so much that I underlined everything pertaining to the character of Danny. And my agent got me an interview at Warner Brothers. I did a test, did another test, did another test. I did 9 of them. After the 8th one, they went back to New York and tested Jimmy and Paul. And then they came back and said, okay, kid, we'll give you one more chance. And I thought it was terrible, the last test, and that's the one that got me the role.
As a gay kid, my favorite Tab Hunter film on The Late Show was Damn Yankees.
Though your jaw has to go, he may come back to you again. So sleep your sleep, old girl. Our love will keep, old girl, till then.
That was a fun film to do. I loved it. It was the original Broadway cast. I was the only outsider in it. And Jack Warner bought that as a gift for me, as a makeup gift, because we'd had a big argument. But I was thrilled about that because it was my first musical. And I loved that cast. I mean, how could you not love Gwen Verdon or Bobby Fosse or Gene Stapleton, Ray Walston? My gosh.
Well, if you've got to dance in a film, Bob Fosse is a pretty good guy to start with.
Well, I told Bobby, I said, I've got 2 left feet. He said, don't worry about it. You'll be fine.
You had trouble with the director, George Abbott.
He didn't want me from the start. He thought Tab Hunter's a little light in his loafers. I thought, oh, really? You know, come on, give me a break. Jack Warner said, I bought it for Tab Hunter, and Tab Hunter's going to do it, period. And you don't say no to Jack Warner.
By then, you were already a really successful recording artist. How'd that come about?
Natalie Wood and I were on promotion in Chicago for a film called The Burning Hills. It was a Louis L'Amour novel that Warner Brothers had put us in. It wasn't very good. The best thing in it was my horse. We were in Chicago, and this DJ, Howard Miller, heard me singing. And he said, did you ever think of recording? And I said, no, gosh. I used to sing in the shower a lot where everybody sounds good. Or I sang in church. And he said, would you mind if I talk to Randy Wood about you? Go in and see him. I said, sure. So Randy Wood was president of Dot Records. He called me in. He heard me sing. He presented me with a tune called Young Love. I recorded it on a Friday. Monday morning, I was driving down Sunset Boulevard, and when I heard it in the car radio, I almost hit a palm tree. I was so nervous and so excited about it. And it knocked Elvis out of the number one slot. stayed there for about 6.5 weeks.
Young love, our love, we share with deep emotion.
And we used Elvis's backup, the Jordanaires. He wasn't happy about that. But then I've got to tell you what happened after that. We recorded an album at Dot, and then Jack Warner immediately called me into the office and said, wait a minute, what the hell do you think you're doing? I said, well, I was asked if I wanted to record, and he said, we own you for everything. I said, but Mr. Warner, you don't have a recording company. He said, well, we do now, and they started Warner Brothers Records.
You recorded a lot, though. There's a lot
I did quite there. A few albums and quite a few singles, yeah.
In the 50s, you were seen as this golden boy, but you were going through so much pain, having to hide your sexuality.
I wasn't so much hiding as running away. Whenever something was kind of scary for me, I would run out to the horses. They were my touch of reality in that unrealistic world of Hollywood. I was very, very comfortable shoveling the real stuff.
Is that basically what Hollywood is, shoveling the stuff?
Well, I think you play the game. I mean, that's your job. In those days, when you were under contract to a studio, you played whatever they wanted you to do. If they're building you into the all-American boy, that's your job. If you don't do the things they ask you to do, either you're on suspension from the studio. Talk to Betty Davis about that. She had 1,000 of them. Either you're under suspension, or they get rid of you and get someone else who will do what they want.
This is Steve Pride, and I'm talking to film legend Tab Hunter. Let's talk about relationships. You dated Tony Perkins.
For about 3 years, yeah. Tony was a very good actor, a very bright young man, had a great sense of humor.
The pressure in any relationship is intense, but to have one where you have to keep it so secret.
Well, I've always felt that it's nobody's business.
But you still had to hide it back in the day.
I never thought about hiding it. I just kept on the go. It's hard to hit a moving object.
Your big comeback, I hate to use that word, but your big comeback in the 80s was thanks to a queer icon and his film Polyester.
John Waters called me up and he said, how would you feel about kissing a 300-pound transvestite? I said, I'm sure I've kissed a hell of a lot worse. And I'd met Divine before, who was absolutely wonderful. And having worked with Divine in Polyester, which was a great experience, it's because of that that we used him in our film, Lust in the Dust.
Which I love.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that, because Alan single-handedly raised all the money for that film. It was a script that I wrote. It started out as The Reverend and Rosie, and it was going to be with Cheetah Rivera and myself. And then I met Alan, and he said, I think it should be a comedy western, and you should call it Lust in the Dust, and you should use Lainey Kazan and Divine as half-sisters. And I thought, whoa, what a great idea. And he left Fox, and that was our first film together.
He rode the west, she rode the rest. Together, they ravaged the land.
God, you're disgusting.
Lust in the Dust, coming soon from New World Pictures.
Tell me about meeting Alan, because that's a love story.
Well, he was at 20th Century Fox. I went in to do an interview with him about having worked at Fox. And I presented my script to him, and he read it and got back to me and said that he thought it was a really good idea. He presented it to Fox, but they passed on it. And then we spoke about that, and he said, I'll leave Fox. I'll find a way of making this happen. He's a very good producer.
When did you know he was the one?
The one. I just never thought of it that way. I just thought, that kid is really sharp. I really like him. He's a decent human being.
You seem to be a very happy person.
You know, I'm a firm believer that somewhere under the pile of crap, there is a pony. Go for it.
Do you think your looks hurt you being taken seriously as an actor?
Probably, but people always put emphasis on the wrong thing. What you are as a person inside and how you think, those are important things. The rest of it is a bunch of garbage.
You're Catholic, correct?
Oh, yeah.
But you had a bad experience coming clean to a priest in confession at one point.
Well, that was many, many years ago. Recently, we had a screening of our film in Connecticut, and only a few miles from the theater was my good friend Dolores Hart. She was an actress, but now she's a mother superior at the Abbey of Regina Laudis there. So I emailed the Mother Dolores and I said, I'd love for you to come to our screening. And she came to it. And Rex Reed and I were up on stage doing a little Q&A afterwards. And he introduced Mother Dolores. She stood up and took a bow. And then, like the flying nun, came down the aisle to the footlights, you know, the front of the stage. And I jumped off the stage to stand by her because I really love her and I've known her a long time. And she looked right out of the audience. And I love what she said. I want to tell you all, there is no hetero, there is no homo, there is only love. I thought, whoa, she's pretty fantastic.
I know Dolores Hart from King Creole with Elvis and Where the Boys Are. Did you ever do a film with her?
She actually did The Pleasure of His Company on Broadway with Cyril Richard. And when I was signed to do the movie, I was sure that it was going to be Dolores Hart, but they gave it to Debbie Reynolds. Of course, I'd known Debbie forever, you know, because we grew up together.
You were on a lot of studio-arranged dates and things with Debbie
Reynolds. I wouldn't call those studio-arranged dates. The studio wants someone to go to an opening, you go. And why not go with somebody you know really well and enjoy being with rather than some pretty thing that's boring? Debbie's a hell of a lot of fun. Always has been. And ever since she blew the French horn in the band at Burbank High School.
And Natalie Wood?
Nat was like my kid sister. She was much younger than me. And I really think she's just a delightful, charming gal. And, of course, I was so thrilled that we were able to get Bob Wagner in our documentary because RJ is, without a doubt, the most level-headed person you'll ever meet. And he never talks about Natalie. And it was wonderful for him talking there about our relationship and all that because the press has been so despicable about Natalie's death. But then the press has a tendency to be like that.
Here you are with your dogs and your husband and your ranch. And what's the biggest misconception about Tab Hunter or Art Galeen?
I don't know.
Do you care?
No.
This has been a conversation with Tab Hunter and the conclusion of Pride on Screen 2015. Tab's memoir and the documentary about his life are both entitled Tab Hunter Confidential. This is Deep Pride. Thanks for listening.
They say for every boy and girl there's just one love in this whole world, and I know I found mine.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Christopher Gall, Michael LeBeau, and Steve Pride contributed program material. Brian Wilson with Van Dyke Parks and Tab Hunter performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, for making this program possible. You'll find more information about the show, the crew, a video teaser for our special From Outlaws to In-Laws compilation CD, and even more at thiswayout.org. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Lucy Chappelle. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on KOPN Columbia, Missouri, WUML Lowell, Massachusetts, 5GFM Kadena, South Australia, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now, y'all stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Today on Against the Grain, what does it take to form a culture of radical struggle from the bottom up? And what does it take to disarm it? I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll speak with acclaimed UK singer-songwriter Rob Johnson about working-class culture, social upheaval, and life after capitalism. That's coming right up. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Art, when discussed by many critics, is often narrowly limited to the highbrow. It's the domain of the wealthy and the cultured. And yet, so much of the great cultural products of the 20th century and into the 21st come out of working-class life, whether it's the music of Black America or, in the UK, a working-class culture that has fundamentally put its stamp on literature and art. Nowhere can this be seen more than in music, whether rock, folk, or punk, all of which have been shaped by a militant oppositional politics. A son of the working class, the radical socialist singer and songwriter Rob Johnson was formed by that culture and has, in turn, shaped it over four decades of social and cultural turmoil. Johnson, who joins me today in studio, has been called Britain's finest songwriter since Richard Thompson and has been a fixture of picket lines and demonstrations in the UK for many years. I should say, in the interest of full disclosure, that I have a connection to PM Press, which has put out a retrospective of Rob's work called A Reasonable History of Impossible Demands. Rob, you came of age in the UK in the 1970s, a time of great social and cultural upheaval, of labor unrest and artistic experimentation. I wonder if you could describe those times for us.
There's a common mythology in Britain put about by post-Thatcher that the 70s were a dismal time and the society was falling apart and there was the winter of discontent and the blessed Thatcher had to come along and cleanse the temple. Having been there, I thoroughly enjoyed the 70s. I thought it was a great time on a lot of levels. I was brought up in a suburb, so it was a fairly economically successful area to live in. But there were exciting things happening. I used to go to the cinema a lot, saw a lot of good films. Music was really exciting. Outside of these cultural events, I was aware that there were big upheavals with a miners' strike that effectively brought down Edward Heath's government, and I was aware that there was general an atmosphere of radicalism. There were revolutionaries and there were revolutions happening all around the world, and I remember being particularly impressed by that moment when the last American helicopter left the roof of the Saigon embassy. I thought that was a marvellous image. And I would say I wasn't politicised then. My dad was a kind of soft, gently welfare statist socialist, and he would always kind of correct me gently if I did something really stupid and reactionary, in the most kindest of ways. And there were experiences at my school that made me appreciate power relationships in society. And it wasn't until I got to university, Sussex University, in the mid-70s that I kind of bumped up against organised radicalism. And Sussex was known as a very red university. It was always going out on strikes and having sit-ins. So I participated in those quite cheerfully and started encountering small Trotskyite sects with interesting newspapers. And I still remember some of the headlines that I thought, oh, yeah, this is great. They got the guns, but we got the numbers and stuff like that. I was pursuing an interest in music that took me towards punk rock before punk rock happened in Britain. So I was an avid fan of the MC5, and that kind of also helped me have the idea that art could convey ideas. I like the Velvet Underground as well. I was gradually assuming the concept that make it my own, that art had something to say, and if you made art, then it ought really to say something and not just sort of bleat, generally. And then I had a really good tutor at university called Edvard Goldstucker, who was had been Dubček's private secretary and president of the Writers' Union in Czechoslovakia.
Dubček, of course, being the reformist communist leader of the Prague Spring.
Socialism with a human face. That was what they're going for. And he'd ended up in Sussex teaching, and he did this course called Modern European Mind, which made everything else pale into insignificance. You get Kafka, Camus, Dostoevsky, Sartre, socialism, and he was a committed socialist. And I came across the songs of Victor Hara as well at the same time, and I realised that that songs could be part of a social process, could be embedded in popular movements. My first demonstration was to oppose Margaret Thatcher when she took milk away from school children.
Right, so this is before she was Prime Minister.
Yes, this was when she was in the Heath government in the mid-70s. And that kind of just bumbled along, really, until Thatcher came into power, when it became obvious that you had to do something because she was evil and had to be opposed.
And before we get to the Thatcher years, which obviously were long and arduous and terrible, let me ask you about when you're talking about politics and culture, about a particular working class culture. And although you went to university, your background is working class.
Yeah.
Class is a very different thing in the UK than it is in the US. In the United States, many working class people identify as middle class, whereas in Britain, for many people, and obviously some of this has shifted over the past several decades, but there's a deeply rooted working class culture which holds working class status as a kind of badge of honor in opposition with a very intense sense of class divisions and class inequality.
Yeah, that was very much the background I grew up with in the 70s. Working class culture and working class values and just working class life was much more central to the cultural discourse of Britain in the 70s. It arose out of several reasons, I think. Working class in Britain had been fairly well organised in trade unions that had achieved a degree of political power, and they had established a position whereby it was accepted by both the Labour Party, who were supposed to be the political wing of the trade union movement, and even the Tory Party, that when running the country, the government would talk to trade unions as a representative of working class interests. So the trade unions, this is deeply to Margaret Thatcher's anger to no end, and the right wing forces that she represented. Trade unions had negotiating rights with government, and there was appearance of a consensus and a partnership between the organised working class and the elected government. And there's that kind of long history of British trade unionism. There's also the fact that in the 60s, suddenly being working class became sexy and culturally sexy, with people like Michael Caine and the whole Beatles. Beatles and pop culture explosion. You get that people like David Bailey and John Lennon, who became cultural icons, who asserted their working class origins. So working class was cool, and that gave the working class a great degree of confidence. And so working class life became the staple of important media, television, cultural events. You had a lot of working class plays coming through in the theatre, and in the 60s and 70s you had working class life as the centre of sitcoms, as the centre of sort of drama, the centre of films in Britain, which was quite significant, and it was sometimes treated affectionately with humour, but it was accepted that this was a legitimate perspective. And although often trade union officials were kind of mocked, because obviously the people in charge of the media mediate a lot of what we receive, they nonetheless seemed to accept that the people in Britain wanted to experienced culture that was set in working class situations with working class values. Not always good values. I mean, there's a fair amount of grisly racism and sexism going on, but that's kind of true at every level.
Also, there were various working class institutions that were separate from the state. I mean, you were talking about the close collaboration of trade unions and whatever government was in power, at least to this expectation that trade unions would have some say. And there are, of course, critics on the left to the degree to which that was not good ultimately for trade unions. But was there not also a sort of whole set of ways that an independent working class culture was sustained, well, certainly prior to that and through those years, that also gave a vibrancy to people who were a part of the working class?
Yeah, I mean, within the umbrella of the official trade union movement, that gave activists and radicals the opportunity to organise with as much disdain for the trade union leadership as it had for the government. So the success of the organised trade union movement was always regarded with a degree of scepticism by a lot of working class people, but those advances did mean that there was space for the working class to organise and engage in activities and people to pursue their interests, whether that be in kind of strikes like there was a Grundvik strike where people would walk out on strike regardless of whether they had official union backing because they felt confident to do so. Or there's also stuff like the Angry Brigade as well going on. The Angry Brigade was kind of like an active armed anarchist kind of resistance to the state, and it targeted property. It was quite principled in its refusal to sort of shed blood, but it was also pretty good at blowing up things, everything from politicians' houses to Bieber, the kind of hippy-dippy shop, because they thought that was kind of reducing the revolution to a commercial transaction. And there's all this going on, and it gives a kind of confidence to people to further their demands and to feel that they have the confidence to stand on their own feet, work together, and be cooperative to achieve their ends. I mean, also culturally, of course, rock and roll was supposed to be working class, and gradually, as the 70s dragged on, it became more and more associated with bloated prog bands that sang about elves and nonsense like that, and then their flares, and you know, the Rolling Stones started hobnobbing with Princess Margaret, and it clearly had no relationship to working class life. So what the working class did was it started its own rock and roll with punk rock, and that was a great explosion of autonomy and talent, and people feeling confident to go out and change their worlds.
And, of course, punk rock was deeply infused by radical politics.
Yeah, and working class politics as well. I would say that there was a great deal of emphasis on being working class in punk rock. Not everybody was. My mate Dave Floyd from Riot Clones sneers heartily at The Clash and insists they were never really working class because I think Mick lived in a flat anyway. But like everything else, it was more complex. But it was political, even when it was saying it was apolitical. You know, it was people who wanted to be creative and to make their experiences the focal point or the starting point for their creativity, rather than working through a set of cliches that had become kind of outmoded and devalued once they'd been processed through the record business and the whole kind of rock business industry.
How did you encounter punk?
Oh, I encountered it through. I fell in love with David Bowie. Thank you, David, because if it hadn't been for you and Ziggy Stardust, I would never have done this. I'd gone into the record shop to buy Simon and Garfunkel's Greatest Hits, only to find. Hopefully no one in England is going to hear this. Only to find a poster of David Bowie, you know, when he's doing his teapot impersonation, perched on a bar stool as Ziggy Stardust on the wall. I thought, oh, that looks pretty interesting. So I had a little listen to the records again. I thought, wow, 5 years. This is just great. So I bought that. And he introduced me to Lou Reed and the Velvet Underground and then introduced me to Iggy Pop, Iggy and the Stooges. And so I bought Raw Power. And I thought, what is this? What is this? I'm not sure I liked it, but I knew it was really good. And so it was just an unimaginable amount of energy, and that is what rock and roll should be all about, I thought. So then I found the MC5, and I also really loved the way that the Velvet Underground just made a huge racket. I mean, Sister Ray, 17 minutes of one chord, and it's brilliant. And so I thought this level of creativity and this intelligence is wonderful. You know, even when it's like, you know, Iggy being dumb, it's got such an intelligence behind it, and it's not pop. It's something else. So at the start of the 70s, I wanted to be like that, and I'd have a band, and I'd try and sound like the Velvet Underground, and audiences would shout, "Play rock and roll! Play some rock and roll!" So when, by the time that Sex Pistols came along, I thought, well, I've seen all this before. I've got all the Stooges albums. This is just poor quality imitation Stooges. So I wasn't that impressed with it, and I also wasn't impressed with the fact that it seemed to be so fashion related. I'd read the New Musical Express and Melody Maker regularly, and it seemed once punk happened, punk became almost a New Musical Express fabrication, and I got a bit tired with it looking so fabricated. And it wasn't until a couple of years later, when I was in Manchester, someone I was on, Jen, her boyfriend Kevin, was a 200% Clash fan, and he kind of tied me to a chair and played me the singles. I went, "Oh, it's good, isn't it?" And he went, "Yes, it is good." So I then realised I'd missed the zeitgeist yet again, because I'd gone to see Patti Smith at the Roundhouse, which apparently everybody who then went on to form the Sex Pistols and the Clash and all those London bands also was there. And I thought, this is really good. I enjoyed this. But I was also at sunny old Sussex University in Brighton, where although it was only 50 miles from London, it was a completely different landscape. Again, it was play rock and roll. And it was Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, man. It's just swamped with kind of like West Coast, like pap. And so I kind of found, I discovered folk music, which I thought was really good because it represented a much more democratic, much less celebrity-based approach to music. And it seemed more cooperative. I thought it had it was a good voice of the working class as well. And when I discovered folk music in the late 70s, you could go to a folk club and you could hear blues, you could hear someone sing jazz, you could hear someone sing musical, you could hear someone sing, "Oh, as I walked out one morning, oh," and that wasn't so bad if it's in small doses, and you'd find singer-songwriters doing something creative. And it was self-organised because folk clubs, they didn't have promoters. It was just someone found a back room of a pub and started a folk club. It seemed to me gloriously democratic and gloriously free of the distance between performer and audience, which punk kind of played with. But, you know, but once you stick something on a stage, and I do this, I play in a band, I know, you know, you've got PAs and you've got a drum kit, you've got a wall of noise. There is a separation between performer and audience that can lead to something hierarchical, which in my experience of folk clubs, it wasn't. You know, there wasn't that separation. And I thought, I liked that. I thought that was a good thing.
But both with folk and punk, that what you've just noted aside, wouldn't you say that there was a broad range within both? Obviously, the Sex Pistols almost were a publicity stunt that dressed itself up with, you know, sound.
Yeah.
To the left of the spectrum were a whole slew of bands that were inspired by Crass and anarchism. And then within folk, the range from what you're talking about to the stuff that's about sheep shearing and so on. And so in some sense, is it hard to even talk about either of them in some unified way?
I think what unites both proper folk music and proper punk music is that they are ordinary people wishing to express their perspectives creatively using music because they like music. And I think music has certain advantages in terms of creative expression that other art forms don't have, and particularly in the late 20th century. I think if you wanted to be creative, then you'd go into, like, if you were at the end of the 16th century, you'd toddle off down to the Globe and become a playwright, because that's where it was happening, man. Or you maybe go and crawl to the Queen and be a poet. And if you were, you know, wanted to be creative in the 19th century, then you'd go down Grub Street and you start writing novels. Maybe in the early 20th century you'd want to be in a film or whatever. But, you know, clearly after the 60s, after, say, Elvis Presley, damn, I don't really like Elvis, but I can recognise what he signified. You know, Presley and the Beatles and the Stones, after that, you'd want to play guitar. You just want to do that because that's, I worked out, that's the way of reaching most people. You could reach a range of people. And, yeah, the good thing about punk and folk when it's done properly, when it's not following an orthodoxy, and that's the one of the problems is that people seem to want to have orthodoxies, even with punk. There are some kind of orthodoxies crept in. Certainly with folk music, orthodoxies have crept in. But it does. They are playful expressions, and they seem to. There are no rules. You can create your own rules, and you don't have to just sing about my baby left me. Sing about other things, which I particularly like that. But I think in folk or acoustic, let's call it acoustic music, I think you can have a range of emotions. You can be funny, you can be sad, you can be joyful. You can do love songs from time to time. People like love songs, and human emotions shouldn't be shied away from. But you have a... It's like, you know, if you look at the great outpourings of popular urban culture in Europe. American history has had a longer tradition of folk music in a way, like going back to Joe Hill and his discovery that you want to organise people, you can do it through songs, and that's carried on through the 20s and the 30s and Pete Seeger et al. Whereas in Europe we had in Britain we had the music hall, which again, although it was crippled by sentimentality and moralistic and awful Protestant moral censorship, like, still had a range of address a range of emotions and a range of situations through its songs and performances. And when you look at what happened in France, which wasn't crippled by the same kind of self-censoring, don't sing about sex, the people like Frehel and of course PF and all those great chanson popular singers out of the music, out of their musical tradition, awesomely creative, a whole range of emotions and experiences dealt within those songs. Urban music can do that and can be nuanced and complex and ambitious and silly, a whole lot of things.
My guest is Rob Johnson. He's a songwriter for over 30 years, teacher as well, and he is visiting from the UK. We're talking about politics and culture. My name is Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So I want to talk to you a whole lot more about these big questions of culture and politics and the medium of song. But before we do that, I wonder if we could just return to where we left off around a kind of political trajectory that I want to trace in this hour that is your own trajectory. Yeah. Of politics and culture in the UK through the really tumultuous last 40 years. And so you set the stage in terms of your own experience and the culture and politics of the 70s going into the 80s of punk, of folk, of protest music, and of a great time of political strife. So why were the 80s such a battleground in the UK?
The 80s represented the right's attempt to, Thatcher, I think, put it, roll back the gains of socialism. After the Second World War, as happened all across Europe, in one form or another, the work of generations that was the workers' movement achieved quite significant gains. You only have to look at, half of Europe became socialist with actually existing socialism. Thanks to the impositions of governments from the Soviet Union. That's something else to talk about. But the rest of Europe, a lot of the resistance in Europe was organised by communists, and they wanted a share of government, which the Americans promptly denied them by napalming them in Greece and stuff like that and doing deals with General de Gaulle, blah, blah, blah. But in Britain, the Americans didn't have to napalm us. They just kept on asking us to pay them their money for their rotten old Sherman tanks they sold us. But the government, we had a new government. There was an election after the Second World War, and our great hero, everybody's supposed to love, the drunken butcher and racist Winston Churchill, was voted out by the people. So in came a kind of reformist Labour government, and it gave us gave us. Thank you very much. And it enacted the welfare state, which was kind of mild-mannered, mild-mannered socialism. Socialism with a very English, deference. We didn't unfortunately get rid of the Queen. We didn't get rid of private medicine. We didn't get rid of private schools. They were all mistakes. It's not, you know, I'm not saying we should have like shot the royal family like they did in Russia. It means they don't come back though. But we certainly should have liquidated the breeding grounds, the public schools. You look at our government, current dictatorship of Cameron, they all went to these grimly nasty public schools.
Which, course, are not public, but private.
So, yeah. Fee-paying, where you privileged people go to enhance their privilege even more so. We should have got rid of those. But the right in Britain, the old establishment, hated it. They thought this was... completely unacceptable. They thought it was unacceptable that working people, admittedly through their bloated organisations of the TUC,
this is the trade union.
Yeah, they thought it was terrible. They had to actually talk to these horny-handed sons of toil with their bad manners and poor education and lack of breeding. So they were working on finding a way of driving back the advances that the workers' movement had made and taking back complete control of the country away from ordinary people. And there was a conspiracy of people doing that. It was Aryan Eve, who was blown up by the IRA in the mid-70s, and his protege was Thatcher. And in Thatcher, they found someone who could get away with murder a lot easier than Edward Heath could, for example. Edward Heath... he was overthrown by the miners. The miners went on strike. Heath went, "Oh, this is a bit of a problem. Let's call an election." Everybody voted Heath out. The Labour Party again was a bit of a disappointment. But the right would not accept the fact they could maybe control things by buying off the Labour Party or the trade unions. They wanted to reassert control and to get rid of things like the welfare state, to get rid of healthcare. To stop education from teaching working class people to think. God damn it, you're teaching them to think. And certainly not to allow the country to be dictated to by working class interests. Thatcher was very good at it. She was very ruthless. She had that added cachet of being the first woman prime minister. But actually she was just seriously a very ruthless spearhead of the right and the establishment. And she set about crushing the trade unions and about restoring the old pre-Second World War, pre-welfare state values. She sold off council houses. She brought in all these laws. She privatised nationalised services. So, you know, all our services from the rail to the water and houses just got sold off. Everything became reduced to a cash nexus again. And she, as the 80s wore on, her utterances became more and more rabid and more unpleasant. She declared there's no such thing as society. Clearly, she represented people who had no interest in the welfare of everybody, only in the well-being of the elite. That's the mindset, that's the philosophy, that's the ethos that the 80s succeeded largely in inflicting on Britain from a very working, you know, from the working class, communal, chummy, collective identity that characterised most of the 70s. In the 80s, that was destroyed and replaced by, well, yuppies and people more interested in their own material well-being than in sharing a collective experience. But the first thing she did, much to my surprise, she fought a good old imperialist war in the South Atlantic over the Malvinas Islands. Two desperate dictators wondering, is it worth chancing everything on a military gamble? And she won, and that bolstered her position. And from that, she felt empowered to take on the miners. The miners' union and the mining communities were the most well-organized, the most independent working-class communities that we had in Britain, and they were well organised. They were the kind of, in terms of industrial muscle, they were the best organised union. They were like the guards unit of the working class. And what she did was she um, She provoked a massive national strike, but she'd also prepared for it by stockpiling foreign coal, and she militarised the police, so the police lost all illusions of being responding to community need and became very much tools of the state. It's something the police have had to live with ever since. She bought them. She bought them, and the police became just the uniformed arm of the Tory party.
And it was a conflict of intense violence, in fact.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. Massive pitch battles. There are always ongoing discussions about the leadership of the National Union of Mine Workers. Arthur Scargill, who was the president, he had achieved a particularly significant victory in the 70s by a mass picket at a place called Saltley Gate, and that kind of won the strike. Most of all of Birmingham turned out to support that. So, and he thought that tactic would work. What he hadn't reckoned on was that the state had also learned from that, and so had militarised its police, had armed them with horses and truncheons and riot shields in a way that the miners weren't armed. So the miners, when they turned out at Orgreave, it was like a trap. The police set out deliberately to physically break the miners, and they physically attacked miners in their homes and communities. They set up roadblocks. It was a violent time it was a battle for the soul of Britain, and unfortunately, the good guys lost.
One of the songs that you've written is a song called Little Vinnie Jones, which in some ways seems to encapsulate the kind of new Britain that came out of this right-wing backlash, the crushing of the working class in many ways, not fully, of course, in many ways, and attack on the left, the rollback of social democracy in Britain. What can you tell us about this song?
It's about a child I taught. I changed his name. Vinnie Jones, I don't know if you know over here, he was a particularly thuggish footballer, and he then went on to become a particularly thuggish actor in films like Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels, where he's just thuggishly standing around, but not with a football, with a shotgun instead. So it's kind of ironic, because little Vinnie Jones, he's the gentlest and nicest of people. And it's an angry commentary upon how people's life chances have become diminished by austerity, by the consequences of what Thatcher did to the welfare state and the possibilities of a provision that supports people rather than throws them on the garbage heap. And I thought about his aspirations, and I thought how once upon a time, you know, like at the start of the 60s, a lot of artists were working class. People went to art school, you know, where they probably just learned to hang out in the toilets with Keith Richards and play guitar, or, you know, Pete Townsend. But nonetheless, you know, not everybody went to art school and had their lives transformed. But if you wanted to, you could. I suppose that's the thing about the 60s and the kind of welfare state provision. If you wanted to, it was possible that you could go to university or art college.
Let's take a listen to Little Vinnie Jones.
Little Vinnie Jones wants to be an artist. He lives up in the flats, in one of them big blocks up the hill, where they don't have any trees and they don't have any gardens. They got wheelie bins and black sacks, a bus stop and that's it. Don't ask me why. Don't ask me why. When we do PE, he always does it barefoot. His dad delivers pizzas. His mum looks 17. He's really good with words. He's really good with numbers. He's really good at making things. He's everybody's friend. Don't ask me why. Don't ask me why. Government says they don't have any money, so they're cutting this, they're cutting that. Work more, pay more, get less. Paying for the rich in their nice big houses with their gardens behind high walls where they never feel a thing. Don't ask me why. Don't ask me why. Don't ask me why. I don't like the rich. 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 Little Vinnie Jones, he wants to be an artist. How many pizzas does it take to get to Monet's garden? How many kids do you think ever wanted to be artists but got stuck inside a flat with some pound shop felt tip pens? Don't ask me why. Ask me why. Don't ask me why. I don't like the rich. 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 Don't ask me why. I don't like the rich. Don't ask me why. Little Vinnie Jones, he wants to be an artist.
And that song is Little Vinnie Jones, written and performed by Rob Johnson, who is my guest today. He's a radical singer-songwriter and trade union activist. His label is Irregular Records, and you are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and in this hour, we're talking about politics and culture in the UK in the late 20th and early 20th century. So the kind of transformation that you have been talking about, Rob, of British society, obviously the ball was put in motion by the Thatcher government, but in fact taken up and run with by successive Labour governments, yeah. Tony Blair obviously being one prime minister. The Labour Party had traditionally an attachment of some kind to the idea of socialism. That got jettisoned.
Clause 4.
Clause 4 was tossed
Workers
out.
Workers by hand and brain should receive a good share of the profit. Yeah.
And in fact, Labour governments, although currently not in power, but Labour governments have actually been, as social democratic governments elsewhere in Europe, some of the most effective vehicles for rolling back the welfare state. Mm. What has that done to notions of a socialist working class based politics in Britain?
It's disenfranchised, I think, a lot of the working class people. The main drive was to achieve some kind of electability. Throughout the 80s, the leadership of the Labour Party was Neil Kinnock, and he became obsessed by electability and by making the party look electable to the right-wing media and to Middle England. What I would say is that the Labour Party only ever gets elected when the Tory Party falls apart. The Tory Party had fallen apart quite comprehensively by 1997. Nonetheless, there was the Labour Party, in order to make itself look electable, snuggled up to all those anti-union laws. We wouldn't repeal them. Never spoke out against poll tax because it thought that would make it unelectable.
This is an incredibly regressive tax.
Yeah. And also was cautious in the way it supported the miners during the miners' strike. A lot of Labour Party activists. Labour Party was full of activists in those days, and they supported. They were opposed to the poll tax. Well, the ones I knew certainly did, and support the miners. Even the Labour Party was going, "Ooh, don't want to do this. Oh, they're violent. Ooh, there's no history of fighting back. It's all waiting to vote us into power." You know, you can see that. You know, once someone gets in a position of authority, their perspective always changes. But what the Labour Party did was it kind of ousted all those activists. So by the time Tony Blair came along with a new Labour, activists were a thing of the past. New Labour was decidedly shiny and middle class.
Then let's talk about the state of radical oppositional culture then. In the ruins of Thatcher, Blair, Brown, then the Tories, Cameron, now the intense austerity that has been meted out in the UK, there was a lot of vibrant culture, as you've described it, in the 80s during these sort of pitched battles, whether it was around the miners' strike or other battles. And some of these, of course, preceded coming through out of the 70s. Yeah. But there was a real kind of confluence of radical politics, radical culture, much of it rooted in working class life. In many ways, the period that we're now in, people's sense of the possible has really changed. People's sense that life could be substantially better has changed, even despite all of the problems with the welfare state in Britain. Returning to that seems utopian. And to think about life after capitalism seems absolutely far out, thinking from on Mars. Mm. So how do you assess the state of radical culture, given that intense rollback of some basic gains that had been won that really left a lot undone? Mm.
Yeah. I think that the a key thing to remember is the end of the Berlin Wall and the end of actually existing socialism. And I think that there was an awful lot of shuffling going on in Britain of people going, well, actually, I was never really a socialist anyway. And I remember seeing that oaf Neil Kinnock on the television. Oh, it's great. Watch the wall coming down. That's brilliant. All that freedom. You know, a little buzz of that freedom. You know, well, get off, Neil. Because you feel you have to. People feel they have to be on the side of the winners. A lot you could criticise the actual existing socialism for, but it represented some kind of gain. And it represented the idea that you could move things forward. And I always say that my understanding is that particularly, I know that the DDR, the people who were organising those protest marches that set the process in motion for the collapse of the DDR.
And the DDR being, of course, East Germany.
Yeah. They wanted more socialism, not less. But that's held up as, you know, history's ended. You can't have an alternative because it doesn't work. These things don't work. And a lot of writers on the left in Britain suddenly started shuffling their feet. So we can't sing songs about barricades anymore. There are no more barricades. We have to sing about personal politics, you know, whatever that is. So there was a diminution of morale, I think, amongst artists, amongst people anyway, and a period of people trying to revise their understanding of how things might be made better. Regardless of that discourse, oppression goes on, and oppression is met by resistance. Now, since the 80s, I would say that the organisations that have, and also the philosophy that has supported resistance, has been dented and has been disabled in many respects. So resistance, it's harder in many respects because there's not the organisation's support for it. There's also not the, you know, the idea that, well, we're not going to win. You know, I know the defeat of the miners. A lot of trade unions were going, like my NUT was saying, well, it's a defeat to miners. Well, there's no point in us going on strike. That's wrong. And experience shows, and a lot of levels, that you can fight back and you can win. And plus, of course, I have to say that I think the state has got a whole lot better in controlling culture, right? Having been caught with its pants down and its checkbook out by punk rock, I think the music business decided we're not letting that happen again. We're not letting anybody with any radical ideas come along and disrupt our money-making machine. And this is particularly so now that when music stops reflecting the reality of working class lives or the reality of working class aspirations, well, people stop buying it. So as the business gets a tighter control of rock and roll becomes less and less meaningful, so less and less people buy it. So it's a shrinking market and the business wants to keep a complete control over that. So the opportunities for the kind of cultural expression that we were used to in the past aren't there because the business isn't going to let anybody come along and say anything that it doesn't it doesn't endorse, like, you know, Oasis, let's all drink champagne and have relationships and be lads. Oh, the business goes, great, it's consumption, isn't it? Let's have more songs about consumption, conspicuous consumption. We like that. It doesn't challenge anything. In fact, it you know, like, conspicuous consumption as reflected in the kind of dreadful rock and roll lifestyles of people like Oasis, it's pure capitalism. It endorses the values of the ruling elite. So we'll have more of that, please. What we won't have is people singing songs that they make up themselves that present an alternative version of the ruling hegemony's discourse. You know, I don't want people coming along and saying, actually, life's not that good, it doesn't, you know, having a girlfriend doesn't really solve all my problems. I'm living on a state, used to be a council estate, and I'm now kind of homeless, and I don't know where. So they don't want that, but there's lots of people doing it. There's such a lot of creativity going on. It's just that the business is no longer interested in creativity. There's a woman in Britain, my mate Grace Petrie, she's like not yet 30. She writes extraordinarily good songs, and she's very committed. But the business won't touch her. They don't go and say, Grace Petrie, she's wonderful, because she won't shut up. You wouldn't be able to get Grace Petrie to write a song. She writes lovely love songs. You know, think Billy Bragg, only shorter and much more political. You know, everything is political with a cut. So, but they won't touch her. They won't. You know, so why would they give space now to somebody who says this is wrong, austerity is crap? They don't. They're not interested in doing that.
I'm not going to ask you the stock question of how can we give young people hope in the dark.
The young people have hope. They turn up with hope. What we got is, it's like, that's the best thing. Sorry, I get best thing about it being an early years educator. You get people before capitalism gets hold of them, before the disappointment set in. People have got hope. Young people have got hope. They've got immense energy skills. So the thing is just to sort of keep that going.
Well, so in line with that, then, as you say, you're dealing with these human beings who haven't got the full force of capitalism and capitalist culture, although obviously it seeps in even when they're infants.
Yeah.
But still, they haven't gotten to that full level of awareness. Is there something that we can learn with them in a non-cliched sense in trying to think about what our lives might be after capitalism, which seems to be so off the table? You know, as you say, we're not even supposed to think about it. Yeah. But if we do think about it...
Well, if you look at young children, they are the thing itself, as Shakespeare said in King Lear. They are an unaccommodated man, and you know, young children, they play. They don't always want. The worst thing I think is we've been lumbered with this capitalist model of life, which is you have to constantly improve things, you have to constantly generate more, and if you don't, you're a loser. Well, young children aren't interested in doing that. Sometimes they will challenge themselves to build a bigger tower out of bricks, and sometimes they won't. Everything's developmental. It's great. I mean, I had a Abdi Rahman. He was from Afghanistan, and he loved playing with trains. Make a train track, circular train track, and the head teacher would come in a Laura Ashley dress and go, Abdi Rahman's playing with the trains again. I go, yeah, nice, isn't it? She comes in, he's playing with the trains again. I go, it's good, isn't it? But what she couldn't notice was that he started off with a small circle, and then he moved to a slightly bigger circle. And then his train tracks became more and more complicated and convoluted, but at his own pace. He wasn't doing it because he wanted to, he was thinking, I must maximise my train production here. It was like, it's exploration and play. And it was play for its own self. And if we try and learn to do things for us, for themselves, that expands. That expands us in a kind of organic way, in a healthy way. If we're always being told to meet targets, if capitalism teaches us that everything must be linear, it's a lineal progress. I think if we try and think in terms of spirals more and circles and like expanding our circles, like children do in their play, right? And they revisit and they tinker with. I think that's a healthy way to how we should kind of live our lives, that we need to have a society where we are allowed to explore, we are allowed to play, we are allowed to sit on a carpet and, you know, and play the train track at our own pace. That's the kind of society we need to move towards, not one that is all about lineal progress and greed and individual assertion. I think Children are great at cooperating together as well. Children like other children. They generally like being with each other. So they do cooperate. They do play. And sometimes you see them going, they do have some power things, like, I'm not your friend. That's obviously needs, that's come some kind of things we can talk about and we can address. Everybody's friends here. And it's better if we are all friends, actually. And children aren't daft. Children far more intelligent than most adults in a kind of instinctive human way. Yeah, they kind of grasp it. Oh, yes, it's better if we're nice to each other. Better if we kind of, we all work together. Far better. They're not daft. Children sometimes go to school to learn to be stupid. So if we kind of look at the model of a child before it gets trampled on, then that might give us a paradigm for the kind of society we'd like to move towards. What do we do when we retire, when we finally give up this race? Well, I've just retired, so I'm actually quite sad I'm no longer a teacher. What am I going to do? Well, I'm going to play. You know, I don't actually want to go and earn more money or whatever. When you retire, what do you want? And that's what, you know, we go through our lives, we're looking forward to retiring when you can not work. So perhaps if we got the kind of working thing more in balance with the play, then that might produce a better society. Things don't always have to be bigger and better. Things perhaps need to just go around in spirals a bit more.
Rob Johnson has been my guest. He is a radical singer, songwriter, trade unionist, teacher, born in London. His record label is Irregular Records, and a retrospective box set of his work has been put out by PM Press. And in the interest of full disclosure, I should say I also have a connection to PM Press. It's called A Reasonable History of Impossible Demands, The Damage to Date, 1986 to 2013. And you've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening. And please tune in next time. And we're going to go out with Rob Johnson's song, Karl Marx City Blues.
In mid-air with his Che Guevara t-shirt and those dreadlocks in his hair. Karl Marx is on his mobile and he Facebooks and he tweets with his hot to Trotsky trilby and those Converse on his feet. And I said, hey,
hey,
what else can you do? I still got the Karl Marx City Blues. Hey,
hey,
what else can you do? I still got the Karl Marx City Blues. Well, Karl Marx was on the demo. Karl Marx was in the crowd. But when they asked him to party, Karl Marx just laughed out loud. Karl Marx has gone electric. Behind the beard, the bloke, he wrote lots of dialectics, but not that many jokes. But I said, hey,
hey,
what else can you do?
Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
Thanks, 10-4.
You're listening to radio news about radio waves. Headlines from the ether. Headlines.
This is Timer with the radio news about radio waves. The three Democrats running for president held their final debate before primaries and caucuses begin, and the three candidates were asked about encryption and whether they favor privacy over security. Here are their answers, cut just to the topic.
I believe whether it's a back door or a front door, that the American principle of law should still hold, that our federal government should have to get a warrant, whether they want to come through your back door or your front door. And I also agree, Lester, with Benjamin Franklin, who said no people should ever give up their privacy or their freedoms in a promise for security. So, well, we're a collaborative people. We need collaborative leadership here with Silicon Valley and other bright people in my own state of Maryland around the NSA. They can actually figure this out. But there are certain immutable principles that will not become antique things in our country so long as we defend our country and its values and its freedoms. And one of those things is our right to be secure in our homes and our right to expect that our federal government should have to get a warrant. I also want to say that while we've made some progress on the Patriot Act, I do believe that we need an adversarial court system there. We need a public advocate. We need to develop jurisprudence so that we can develop a body of law that protects the privacy of Americans in the information and digital age.
I just wanted to add, in the previous question, I voted against the USA Patriot Act for many of the reasons that Governor O'Malley mentioned. But it is not only the government that we have to worry about, it is private corporations. You would all be amazed, or maybe not, about the amount of information private companies and the government has in terms of the websites that you access, the products that you buy, where you are this very moment. And it is very clear to me that public policy has not caught up with the explosion of technology. So, yes, we have to work with Silicon Valley to make sure that we do not allow ISIS to transmit
information. But in terms of lone wolves, the threat, how
would
you do
it? We have got to do there is, among other things, as I was just saying, have Silicon Valley help us to make sure that information being transmitted through the Internet or in other ways by ISIS is, in fact, discovered. But I do believe we can do that without violating the constitutional and privacy rights of the American people.
Secretary Clinton, I cut you off. I'll give you 30 seconds to respond on the issue of lone wolves.
Well, I wanted to say, and I'll do it quickly, I was very pleased that leaders of President Obama's administration went out to Silicon Valley last week and began exactly this conversation about what we can do consistent with privacy and security. We need better intelligence cooperation. We need to be sure that we're getting the best intelligence that we can from friends and allies around the world.
Andrea, just a quick follow-up, though,
Andrea,
Secretary Clinton.
Yes, Andrea,
just a moment, Governor.
Get my 30 seconds,
but Secretary please. Clinton, you said that the leaders from the intelligence community went to Silicon Valley. They were flatly turned down. They got nowhere.
That is not what I've heard. Let me leave it at that.
This is Tamara reporting for Wayfarm Radio and WGXC.